My power rests in the east, but my hand is stretched out to the west. I shall restore the lost grandeur of China. When your civilization, as you are pleased to term it, has exterminated itself, when you've reduced to ashes your palaces and your temples, when in your blindness you've set back the clock which so laboriously you fashioned, I shall stir. Out of the fire I shall rise. The red dusk of the west will have fallen. The golden dawn of the east will come. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On the 1st of September 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Also, radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, live, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling the vote winners like Boris and Trump, while Big Pharma and Mac Hancock and Bill Gates, the crimes against humanity, are all forgotten now because of the evil Putin, the Goldman Sachs Nazis, po-faced bunch of Bilderberg death trip losers, Nick Land's dark enlightenment drones want us as slaves to their machines, and also the wife-murdering king, the accelerationist cults now waging war on the British people as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it were taken off the reins. Anyway, and hadn't been occupied by the Zionist lobby. So helping us navigate through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the first part, we'll be looking at the replacement as Defence Secretary, Benton Wallace, not by Tom Tugendhat, that I predicted, the Bilderberger, but by Grant Shapps. Safe pair of hands, eh? Rishi's fighting spirit on the way to next year's general election. Also, tritium and the release at Fukushima. Just how dangerous really is it? I had an excellent, fascinating conversation with the low-level radiation campaign's Dr. Chris Busby earlier this week, who explains to us what tritium is and just how dangerous this release is compared to the other releases of tritium there have been over the years. And also, in part two, we look at the coup in Gabon. We have Tucker Carlson, an extract from his interview with Viktor Orban, Hungarian boss, and also a little look at the German Saturnalia from an occult book. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Martin, we'll start, I think, with Ben Wallace and the announcement yesterday that Grant Shapps is taking over as Defence Secretary, the most obvious point being that he's had no experience in defence whatsoever.
Well, it doesn't make much difference in the way the British system works, to be honest. I mean, you can be put in charge of stuff that you know nothing at all about as a minister here. So, for example, our Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, who has just been out in China, he is a politician and, you know, he probably had some interest in foreign affairs, but perhaps not as much as some other people might have had. But, of course, in the Russian system, the foreign minister, Lavrov, is a professional diplomat. He answers to the political leadership, but he is himself a bureaucrat, if you like. And, of course, he really does know what he's talking about compared to people like James Cleverly or, God help us, Liz Truss.
So what do you make of Shapps in charge? I mean, we're entering a really dangerous phase, aren't we, particularly with the possible escalation in Ukraine. And also there is this obvious thing that's going on right now, which is the Brits and the Americans supplying intelligence information to the Ukrainians, plus the weapons, to actually hit Russia.
Well, it is. It's an extremely dangerous situation. Britain has placed itself right at the forefront of the people prosecuting the war in Ukraine to the limit. Maria Zakharova this week, and she's another professional diplomat in the Russian foreign ministry, she was saying, well, goodbye Ben Wallace, Agent 006. You leave the battlefield in disgrace, having covered it with depleted uranium. Goodbye and good riddance. So that's the attitude that I'm afraid the Russians are taking towards the British. They see us as very much behind these terrorist attacks that have been happening inside the Russian Federation.
Which terrorist attacks?
Well, the one on Pskov this week, where they attacked the airfield with drones which were made in Australia. And they've either flown from Estonia or they've flown by teams inside Russia. And of course, various politicians in this country and in the US have gone about it. Well, I think Baerbock, who's the foreign minister in Germany, says that these kind of attacks in Russia are legitimate attacks, because it's a way of taking the war to the Russian population and making them see that blah, blah, blah. But of course, by the same token, if the Russians were to do that in Germany or in Britain, everybody would be up in arms. But of course, at some point, and they won't give a warning of this, they may decide to blow up a pipeline in Britain or sink an aircraft carrier, just to make a point. And they won't warn us about it when they do it. That's how dangerous this is.
Don't you think maybe the sort of thing the Russians might do is a drone attack here?
Well, that's exactly what I'm suggesting, Tony. I don't think they've done anything like that so far. They'd certainly had nothing to do with the Skripal affair, for example. So they've been set up to make it look as if they're carrying out terrorist attacks of various kinds in the West when they're not, on like Gladio, which definitely was. But at some point, you've got to recognise that the other side are going to say, right, you think it's okay to attack the Kerch Bridge and kill two parents and put a 14-year-old girl in a coma. We're not going to cut your civilians, but we think like we talked last week about Zakarchenko, who's the Prime Minister of Donbass Republic, having his head blown off, probably by British special forces. Now, I think that should be hammered home to Sir Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. Prime Minister's a fair game then. Do you realise that? And they're probably fair game forever. So even when you retire, you're still fair game.
I mean, is there any sort of advantage or disadvantage for one side bumping off the other side's leadership? I mean, this seems to be not necessarily a very helpful tactic.
No,
there's
not.
Always, I mean, it might be, for example, if you've got your agents at a sort of second tier level to kill off the leadership at the very top, it might be that you will then gain more influence as your agents become more influential.
Well, I mean, this is a lot of what goes on. I mean, you can imagine the internal politics of the IRA was very much involved with who's a traitor and who's going to have to be dealt with and all the rest of it.
Turned out the guy who was making those decisions was working for the British Army.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, they it was all infiltrated, as these things are. No doubt the West has got some. I think what they've actually got inside Russia isn't high-level spies, because the Russians are quite good at working out who they could possibly be. What they have got is low-level saboteurs, because, of course, Ukrainians and Russians speak virtually the same language. They're indistinguishable. It's very easy for them to infiltrate, just as it's easy for the Russians to infiltrate into the Ukraine. And, of course, the Russians haven't gone for the top leadership in the Ukraine. They've been trying to negotiate with them. They have gone for specific targets, like the SBU, the SBU, which is the secret police, after the Belgrade incident. So what happens is when the Ukrainians, with British support, carry out these various provocations inside Russia, then the Russians, lots of NATO soldiers have been killed. I was reading a suggestion that up to 10,000 Polish soldiers are already dead. So this is very serious. It's as serious as it gets.
Well, I mean, anyway, it's also, of course, the responsibility of the authorities and the press to be explaining this to the political classes and the general public. So a decision can be made about whether that's a wise way to proceed. But it seems to me, in the West particularly, the censorship is so full on that it's almost as if they could, maybe you're right, maybe 10,000 Polish soldiers have died and no one's actually found anybody. It might be, we may be having to wait for RT on the other side of the firewall or Sputnik Live or something to tell us and explain to us and give us the evidence that 10,000 Polish troops have died.
Well, we know it's definitely hundreds of thousands have died, and the Poles have been, what they are, they're Polish regular army who've been told or volunteered to go and fight in the Ukraine. And I suppose from the Russian point of view, all these people turning up in dribs and drabs to be killed is the way to defeat NATO.
Isn't this what the special forces are for these deniable type operations?
Well,
operations.
We're not talking about special forces, because special forces are small numbers of people especially trained in certain things. We're talking about regular army.
But they're in there too, aren't they, the special forces?
Oh, the special forces are in there too. Of course they are. They've admitted that the SAS have got people all over the Ukraine. Now, in other words, from a Russian point of view, we're already at war with them. Of course, what they haven't done, the Russians at this stage, is hit back in Britain. But I think that will be their first choice target.
Well, it may be a matter of time. Anyway, the person who's got to manage all this is the glorious Grant Shapps, if you can possibly believe that, folks. And I was listening yesterday to Talk Radio, and I heard Isabel Oakeshott, who I don't often agree with, but I thought she did a pretty good analysis of the type of leadership we've now got here in Britain.
Let's say very good morning to Isabel Oakeshott. Isabel, how are you?
Morning. I'm very well, thank you, though I am really exercised by the sudden departure of Ben Wallace, who was an excellent defence secretary, and we really needed that in these times when we're basically looking at war in Europe. And the Prime Minister's decision to replace him with Grant Shapps, I think, is quite extraordinary. Not because Grant Shapps isn't actually, by some measures anyway, a pretty effective minister. He's very energetic, which is more than can be said for a lot of cabinet ministers. He's a very good communicator, and he is able to get things done. And he did stand up as Transport Secretary for a long time to the dreadful unions. But the problem is that he has no background whatsoever in defence. And as someone who's written a book on the state of the armed forces, from a base of zero knowledge, I knew nothing about the armed forces, didn't know one end of a ship from the other. I can say that it is an extraordinarily challenging subject to get your head around. It takes months to understand, even to develop a fundamental understanding of the armed forces. They are absolutely riddled with acronyms. You know, they can't help themselves. It's like a foreign language. He's going to need to go around with a kind of little dictionary explaining what some of the terminology is. I can't see him being able to wrap his head around any of this for probably 6 months. And the Tories likely only have a year left in office. Yeah. There is a war raging. It just seems inexplicable to me.
It really does seem weird, because what you can see with Grant Shapps is the old Margaret Thatcher-style picture of him sitting in a tank with his head poking out the top with a helmet on. Because you might remember that famous picture of Rishi Sunak, and I think it was Zelensky he was with, both getting onto a military helicopter with their kind of, you know, top gun gear on. And that's what it's all about. It's all about photo shoots.
Yeah, I mean, and Liz, there's a photo of Liz Truss doing something similar, trying to reprise a kind of Thatcher stance. They all do it. It's frankly embarrassing if they don't have any background in defence. I mean, Ben Wallace is a military man, so he knew what he was talking about. Now, it's not unusual to appoint people with no background in defence to the job. It's happened before. But I think what's different here is the time frame, that it is only a year at the most till the next election, and the fact that we've got a war raging with Russia. So I just find it, frankly, inexcusable that this decision has been made when there are several people that Rishi Sunak could have chosen who could have gone straight in, rolled up their sleeves and known what they were talking about.
Exactly right. But it then says more about the Prime Minister, does it not, than it actually does about Grant Shapps? Because Grant Shapps will obviously do whatever job he's given. He'll quite happily do his master's bidding and all of that. But this tells you, does it not, that Rishi Sunak simply wants somebody in that role, and in every role, who just does what they're told.
So Rishi Sunak is beginning to remind me ever more of one David Cameron.
Yes.
You know, a guy that essentially sees the role of Prime Minister as a sort of manager, a chief executive, someone who is there to neutralise problems rather than to actually do something creative to solve the problems. You know, David Cameron famously said that he wanted to neutralise the NHS for the Conservatives. They had a fantastic opportunity to do so much more than so-called neutralise it so it's not a political problem for them, and look how that worked out. They could actually, over the last 12 years, have reformed it. But that isn't how David Cameron saw his job, and nor does it seem to be how this Prime Minister sees his job.
Well, Martin, what's about what she's saying there about this whole sort of managerial style, where actually what you want is someone who's going to manage it, it doesn't need to actually have any expertise whatsoever, parachuting in, I think they call it.
Well, I mean, where she's coming from is that Rishi Sunak isn't a true believer in the, you know, when she's talking about reforming the health service, she means get on and privatise it. And of course, Cameron didn't want to do that. He knew that that was very unpopular. And I'm afraid the Tory party talks a lot to itself these days. This kind of programme is for them to talk to themselves
She's also making some good points, though, about this style of government. I mean, it's quite obvious that Goldman Sachs Sunak he's just trying to arrange around himself, and probably with all of his help of his advisors, people he knows and trusts personally very well. It's a kind of running it by clique. The idea is, as they run into a general election, nobody's going to speak outside what they're supposed to. They're not going to be thinking for themselves and speaking for themselves. They're going to all be singing from the same Rishi Sunak Goldman Sachs hymn sheet.
Well, I think if he's hoping for that, he's not going to get it, because the right wing of the Conservative Party don't really accept Sunak as the Prime Minister. You see what Nadine Dorries was saying on her way out the door last week. And they are going to be attacking... I mean, this kind
so
of...
So what was she saying?
Well, Nadine Dorries was saying that Rishi Sunak killed Boris Johnson, and he's you know, the real problem is that the Tory party hasn't got enough, you know, they should... I mean, she backs... There's still a Liz Sunak tendency, and she would be part of it. Not Liz Sunak, I mean Liz Truss, tendency. Yes. I think...
Well, I thought she was a Boris fan.
Well, she was, yes.
But obviously Boris is out of it.
Yes, but I mean, the point I'm making about this is that the Tory party are facing a potentially electoral annihilation in just over a year's time. The main managers that used to run it, like Conservative Central Office, they just want a steady-as-she-goes approach, like no more drama. We've had enough drama. Rishi Sunak is boring. We want him to be perceived as boring. He's just a safe pair of hands. And that's presumably why Grant Shapps' name has just come out of the hat and he's just got to be slotted in.
So what's the difference between the Conservative Central Office and the headquarters of Goldman Sachs, then?
Well, the headquarters of Goldman Sachs is busily selling the pound and doing all sorts of other things, you know.
There's a bit of a conflict of interest there,
well,
you know.
Well, there is a conflict.
You've got a Prime Minister who's actually very close to this massive investment bank, one of the biggest in the world. And actually, they are an extremely politicised bank, aren't they? They're funding all political races.
Don't forget, they're only a bank because they were a hedge fund and they were turned into a bank by the Americans so that they could be bailed out as a bank. Yes, I mean, that is an Achilles heel for Sunak, because he is basically perceived as a very rich person connected to the very top of that kind of pole. And of course, that's not Lee Anderson, the deputy chair of the Tory party, whose father was a miner. But on the other hand, this is the problem. The problem the Conservatives have got is the coalition that they've created around Brexit includes, knuckle-dragging nationalists and high-flying globalist hedge fund people. But they can't keep the two wings together. They're at each other's throats.
Goldman Sachs interested in Brexit?
Goldman Sachs, I'm not talking about Brexit as such, I'm just talking about the general
lie. Are they? And the answer is no. The answer is no. No, they're not interested. Goldman in fact, that's the last thing in the world they want.
Goldman Sachs want to see whatever happens to
the United States of Europe. And, well, they are very political. They're Bilderberg Bank. They want to see the United States of Europe in partnership with the United States of America.
Well, let me put it this to you. Rishi Sunak has been a solid Brexiter ever since he went to Winchester College and was head boy. Solid Brexiter all the way, and he worked for Goldman Sachs. So it doesn't really add up what you're saying.
Well, it does, actually.
No, I would suggest to you that Goldman Sachs make money off everything, and they've got people in there who are pro-Brexit and people who are anti-Brexit. Yeah. That's not really...
I suppose what Goldman Sachs would like is a kind of pretend Brexit. You know, he's the perfect guy to do that.
Because the mispricing of assets, as you take Britain out of the single market, it gives the opportunity for hedge funds to make loads of money. Crispin Odie was his hedge fund. He's been kicked out of it for, maltreating the female staff. He bet against the pound solidly all the way while he was funding Brexit. So, in other words, he was funding Brexit so he could sell the pound.
We knew that the elite play both sides of the chessboard.
They don't they?
They certainly do.
That's the point of making.
Right, so why Ben Wallace resigned? Well, let's have a listen to... Do you want to say why you think he resigned?
He resigned because he wanted to be head of NATO, and because, in actual fact, the Americans, I understand, didn't want him to be head of NATO because he was too gung-ho for the Americans.
No, not true. No, he was actually... He was taking the mickey out of Zelensky in public, press conferences.
Yes, well, he did that as well. Yes,
so come on. He decides who's going to be the head of NATO
is Joe Biden. Biden decided he didn't want him for whatever reason.
Well, let's have a listen to what Dave in Exeter had to say about this, who phoned in yesterday.
The last straw for Ben was really the Biden and Washington administration blob over there, kicking him in the teeth and backing the Empress of European Defence in Ursula von der Leyen.
For the NATO job, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not a sudden. This is not news to anybody in these circles. You know, this was coming at that point. And you could see him getting afraid when he sort of made the comments about, you know, well, look, I'm not Amazon just to sort of do deliveries here to Ukraine. So, you know, this is not news. There've obviously been a sort of, a period there where they've gone, right, I've had enough. You know, in fairness to him, 4 years of this must be, you know, it's a really tough position. But what you've got to understand is it's David Williams that's in charge. And it's not the top brass that are in charge. They've been to Rishi and Hunt to say that our military is broken, we need more resourcing and investment, and Rishi and Hunt have already refused.
Yeah.
You're not going to see a change of policy where they're going to put resourcing into our military to bring it into some sort of a position where it's no longer a deterrent force. And if you want to sort of put it into the proper context, in 2010, Admiral Sandy Woodward, who led the task force of the Falklands, went on the record and said that we could no longer, as the baton handing over event between Blair, Brown and Cameron, when the Cameron government come in, he went on the record and said, as it stands at the moment with this defence review where they cut out all the capability, we could no longer defend anything other than either end of the channel. And nothing's changed during this Tory period.
It's shocking, isn't it? Dave, fascinating to hear you talk. I'd love to talk more, but we've got to run. But thank you for that insight. And you're obviously somebody that knows an awful lot about the inner workings of the Department of Defence.
Yeah, so really, I mean, the military now is rather, even when it comes to defence, actually defending, it can't really do these offensive things. So it's interesting, isn't it, that all they're really doing by helping Ukraine is not sending over loads of soldiers to help the Ukrainians or whatever. They're doing a bit of training down in Salisbury Plain, etc., and probably over in the west of Ukraine too. But it's really intelligence, it's satellites, and it's the Americans, and it's sending weapons over.
Yes, it is. And of course, the fundamental delusion that these commentators have got is that Britain should have an army that could invade Argentina. In fact, we don't need to have an army to invade Argentina. We don't need to have an aircraft carrier to go and make trouble in the South China Sea. In actual fact, we could legitimately reduce our defence expenditure by negotiating peace.
But what they're suggesting, both of them are suggesting there, is that, and Mike Graham is agreeing with him, is that there isn't really even a proper defensive capability in the British Army now.
Well, and what's happening now is all the Challenger tanks that have been sent to the Ukraine, which are very soon going to end up being missiled by the Russians,
brewed up, I think they call it.
Yes, that's right. And of course, if the whole British Army, all 70,000 of them, turned up to the Ukrainian front tomorrow, they would last about a month, because that's the level of attrition. Britain says that still has a fantasy that we've got a global reach with our military. And the only way we've got that is on the back of the United States. So we follow the United States into every conflict, specifically Iraq, for example, where France and Germany said we don't want to get involved here. But we did. Now, that's why we spend more money on defence than other European countries, and we spend it badly. We spend it on things like Trident, which we are never going to use. It's absolutely pointless. It's got no military purpose whatsoever. We probably do need a flexible little army to go and do peacekeeping operations when we start making peace. But if we're determined to go to war with Russia, no amount of money will allow us to win. We are going to lose either way, and we might as well cut our losses now.
With the United States, there is talk this week of actually expanding the Americans. We had Fairford the other week with the drones, Americans' ability to base nuclear weapons here in Britain. I mean, is there any sort of agreement, public agreement, between the British and the Americans as to whether they can keep nuclear weapons here? Because that obviously makes Britain a target. I mean, it goes back to the 1980s and this whole idea of Airstrip 1.
Well, yes, I mean, and don't forget the cruise missiles, when they were brought into Europe, in Western Europe in that period, were destabilising, because they were short-range weapons based in Western Europe, and the Russians were faced with the possibility that they would be attacked from Western Europe very quickly before they could respond. And I think the real goal, surely, should have US and Russian nuclear weapons should be intercontinental missiles, so that there's at least half an hour for people to make up their mind what's happening, and all the other small stuff should just be removed from the battlefield, as was agreed with Gorbachev in the Intermediate Forces Treaty. But Britain has supported the US in ripping up that treaty, which is one of the reasons why the fighting in the Ukraine is going on. Britain has played a pernicious role in this fighting in the Ukraine. We've used our minuscule power, such as it is, to create more trouble rather than talk sense. And that, of course, is a shame on this country. And, of course, you know, ultimately, when people in charge are as wicked as that, because that's what it is, then the price has to be paid, and it will be paid.
So, yeah, increasing evidence that the US's nuclear mission, this is, I think, is the Federation of American Scientists, just put out this week, that the US Air Force's nuclear mission may be returning to UK soil. RAF Lakenheath upgrades. They've got some satellite photos of RAF. I mean, it's just like a kind of Google map type thing of Lakenheath in East Anglia. New US Air Force budgetary documents strongly imply United States Air Force is in the process of re-establishing its nuclear weapons mission on UK soil. The Air Force FY2024 budgetary justification package, dated March this year, notes the planned construction of a surety dormitory at RAF Lakenheath, approximately 100 kilometres northeast of London. The surety dormitory was briefly mentioned in the Department of Defence testimony to Congress March 2023, but with no accompanying explanation. Surety is a term commonly used within the Department of Defence and Department of Energy to refer to the capability to keep nuclear weapons safe, secure and under positive control. Whatever that positive control means. The justification documents note the new requirement to construct a 144-bed dormitory to house the increase in enlisted personnel as a result of the potential surety mission. The emphasis has been added there. To justify the new construction, the document notes, with the influx of airmen due to arrival of the potential surety mission, I suppose that's because the Americans are building all this stuff, even though the British haven't yet agreed to it. Maybe that's one of the things Grant Shapps is about to sign off. And the bed down of the two F-35 squadrons there is a significant deficiency in the amount of unaccompanied housing available for E-4s and below Royal Air Force Lakenheath. So anyway, the point here, Martin, is they're building all this stuff. The Federation of American Scientists is a fascinating little bunch, aren't they? Because a lot of them are retired military people.
The Federation of what?
American Scientists.
All right. Well, I mean, that's obviously quite a detailed little
this
breakdown.
This is the retirees in the States looking at all this stuff, going through, pouring through these documents and saying, hang on, look at this.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, Britain is the US's number one, if I use the word ally, it sounds pretentious because we're not an ally. We just do as we're told. We're absolutely reliable. Apart from the fact what happened with Wallace, coming back to him, he was speaking out of turn because the Americans at some point may want to ditch the Ukrainians. And if they do, they don't want the British, you know, the British just like eager little yapping dogs, you know. As at some point, the Americans will, look what happened in Afghanistan. Biden decided he was pulling out, and then he told the British, and then the British had to get out because they weren't even consulted, because that's our relationship with the United States.
If you go around Europe, you can see where these nuclear weapons are, the American ones. You've got in Turkey, Intelik Air Base, and a couple of others down there. Main one, massive one, is Intelik. Then in Germany, you've got Ramstein Air Base. And now it looks like RAF Lakenheath is being added to that. Now, it certainly looks as if the Americans are simply using and abusing Europe to wage a proxy war on the Russians, doesn't it?
Well,
the question is why? What is it the Americans have got against the Russians so much?
Well, the reason for all this is because they won't treat with them as equals. They basically, they were quite happy when Yeltsin was selling the country off for peanuts to them. And then when he was got rid of and the Russians, you know, stabilized their ship, as it were, they got increasingly, you know, they could have dealt with Putin. Putin was quite happy to deal with them. In actual fact, when Putin first came to power, he was regarded as a potential safe pair of hands to keep the communists out, which of course he has done. But he's done it by tacking in a direction which the population in Russia appreciate, because he's basically improved their living standards and rebuilt the state as a place where, you know, you can go to the police and expect them to bust the gangsters if you're being shaken down. All of that. And of course, there's no reason why we couldn't have a reasonable relationship with the Russians. But there's two things about it. One, they want the raw materials in Siberia, but they don't want to share. They want their multinationals to have it all. They're not interested in joint stuff. And there is also a very strong strain of Russophobia in Western culture. The British have always had a thing about the Russians. And even going back to the 19th century, would remember, we sent our boys to the Crimea to fight the Russians. And as Ben Wallace famously said, as a Scots Guards captain, the Scots Guards went to the Crimea in 1854 and we gave the Russians a beating. And I'm sure we could do it again, he said.
Very much
the great Napoleonic genius.
This is basically part two stuff we're doing here. We're getting into that whole area, but we've got some more stuff after the break. But my feeling is that there is a war being concocted between the Chinese and the United States, and many people on both sides just simply hate the other side for all the right reasons or the wrong reasons. But there is what I'm saying is there is a sort of Dr. No faction that hopes to gain from this, and the Americans are quite aware that if such a conflagration was to take place, that the Russians would be sort of stood by watching, a little bit like the Swiss were in the Second World War in Europe, and come out of it much better, having been able to sort of play one side off against the other, and might even end up as the great world superpower after a Russia-America war.
Well, look, I mean, the Russians and the Chinese are well aware that the West...
Sorry, after a China-America war. Yeah.
Yes, but if there's a China-America war, the Russians are already at war with the West, and the Chinese are preparing to fight over Taiwan. That is the reality. And the Americans are preparing to fight over Taiwan. The head of the US Navy in the Pacific said we're going to be fighting with them by 2025. So, you know, whatever you were thinking about your holidays or where you might be going or what you want to do with your life or study somewhere or get a new job, factor in the fact that we're going to be at war with Russia and China by 2025, and we're already at war with Russia. Now, that means once you, this is very serious. It's as serious as it's been since World War II. And people still think that the consumer society that they used to, buying a new car and all that, that's what it's about. It's not.
Okay, just looking, zooming into Bristol for a minute, one of the stories this week we've been following for years now, which is this bizarre attempt, really, decadent attempt, I suppose you'd say, for housing speculators to demolish the oldest zoo in the world, a municipal zoo in the world, that is to say Bristol Zoo, and put on it a load of kind of themed luxury housing. So, you know, you can have maybe the old ape house next to your house or in your garden, this sort of thing. So obviously someone somewhere has thought, well, we could sell this for like loads of money. And of course, that's what they've got. Bristol Zoo this week, Martin, we've heard that Bristol Zoo's housing development plans are to go ahead. Central government has refused to intervene. Now, there were a lot of people, George Ferguson, etc., the former mayor, have been writing to central government saying, look, this is just it's a stitch-up, basically. So the mayor and the planning officers here in Bristol have just got together with speculators to force this through, even though it goes against almost every rule in the book.
Well, why is, if the local authority had okayed this development, who appealed?
Well, what's happened is that local residents and people like George Ferguson, the campaign to save the zoo, or actually to do something rather different at the zoo, which is some sort of continue on the idea of a visitor attraction, have appealed to central government to call it in because it's such an obvious stitch-up.
Yeah, well, the central government, because don't forget the central government run by the Conservatives is dominated by property developers, and if Bristol Council has agreed it, they're not going to overturn it, are they? I mean, it's all, you know, the speculators get what they want in this country. They always have. They still do.
I don't even know who the Secretary of State is for the environment these days. But anyway, declined to call in the decision. Campaigners have been rallying against plans to overturn planning permission for the former zoo site in Clifton, with planning permission for 196 new luxury homes secured in April early this year. Owners Bristol Zoological Society has permission to begin construction on the gardens, although this isn't expected to start until 2025. The charity said the development would help pay for its new location near Cribbs Causeway, known as the Bristol Zoo Project. In other words, right out of town, near the M5. Great. I'm sure those animals would love living up there. Despite the planning permission, Save Bristol Zoo Gardens had pledged to keep fighting against the controversial scheme and was considering taking legal action, with hopes for the Secretary of State to call in the application and carry out an inquiry into the proposal. However, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees confirmed online that the housing development will proceed as plans. He shared on X, formerly Twitter, plan for 200 new homes will proceed. So what seems to have happened here is we've now got a mayor and a head of planning in Bristol that simply do what the property speculators and developers want. It's difficult to imagine a more grotesque scheme where you've got a wonderful visitor attraction that's so successful, known around the world, rather than maybe, you know, upgrading it or spending a little bit of money on it, making it a bit more high tech and interesting for kids, etc. I know, we can just sell it off and make a load of money.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Bristol Zoological Gardens Society, presumably, who've made all of these decisions.
And well, I met some of them, yeah. They're a funny bunch, actually.
Well, so, in other words...
You ever read the book The Old Men at the Zoo? Did you ever read that years ago?
No.
Well, it's a terrific read, and there's a little sort of fascistic twinkle in their eye, kind of animalistic. And I've met some of these people.
Well, I mean, if the charity concern, which is what it is, decides they want to sell off the property, then it's going to be it's very difficult for anybody to block whatever is proposed. And in any case, even if the council, and I think in this case I would agree with George Ferguson, Marvin's got this wrong, even if they had opposed the proposal, it would have gone to the Secretary of State, who wouldn't have declined to intervene and would have intervened and said, go ahead. That's the problem. When I've had dealings with the planning department in the council, when I worked for the council, it was made obvious by the planning people that the problem is we've got no power. We can oppose schemes, but then the developers can appeal and they always win. And that's the problem.
A few other local stories. The West of England Combined Authority, which no one really knows quite what they do. I think they do something to do with transport, maybe buses, which are an absolute terrible mess. West of England Combined Authority chief executive is to receive a £219,000 payoff. And also we've got the Bristol Deputy Mayor, Councillor Craig Cheney, is going to be standing down next May. I mean, next May is what it's all about, a lot of this politics, Martin, isn't it? Because it looks quite likely that the Green Party will be the largest single party with the largest number of councillors next May, doesn't it, when we stop using the mayor system.
It does, but they might not be able to form a administration on their own. They might have to negotiate with other parties. That's definitely also possible.
Yeah, but that's kind of normal when you've got your Conservative Party, you've got a very strong Lib Dem faction here in Bristol, because the Lib Dems traditionally ran the city before the mayor system came along. So with four parties, it's very unlikely that one of those is going to get an overall majority. But what they tend to do is they'll sit down, maybe the Greens will sit down with Labour. The Greens will be in charge, but they will be pushing a few Labour policies through too.
Well, I'm not directly involved in any of this because I don't know, it's above my pay grade, as it were. We'll have to see what happens. I mean, Bristol is a bellwether of, you know, it's always had a relatively progressive demographic here. So, I mean, the Greens are probably going to hang on in Brighton at the general election. And of course, if they do win the council election here, that will set them up because they hope to unseat Thangam Debonair as Bristol West MP, because the changes of the boundaries ought to aid them. So we might see at the general election that Thangam goes and you get the second green MP, which is maybe wonderful in one way, but of course it doesn't change anything about going to war with Russia, the collapse of the banks and all the rest of it.
Well, we're going to take a look now at the 26th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana. I'm not sure if that was you just raising your eyes to heaven, Martin, but I mean, I know you're no great fan of Princess Diana, but I mean, it is quite an important episode, I think, simply because there is very little actual discussion about the details of how she was assassinated, which I believe she was assassinated. Just taking a sort of moon's eye view of all this, what's your honest take on whether she was killed, and if so, why?
Well, I think the idea that she might have been killed is perfectly straightforward. Knowing what I know about how the state works in Britain and the rest of NATO, they do kill people. So it's quite feasible that they would have organised to do exactly that. But
can you just get maybe with a couple of examples explain why you believe that?
Well, because the Prime Minister of Italy, Aldo Moro, supposedly kidnapped by the Red Brigades, was kidnapped by NATO intelligence services and murdered. We mentioned Zakarchenko earlier, the elected Prime Minister of the Donbass, had his head blown off by presumably a NATO terrorist.
That's because NATO is and Ukraine are in a semi-state of war with the Russians. I mean, were they at war with Diana as well?
Well, what I'm saying is, I'm putting it in context, that if they could easily have done that if they wanted to. There's a lot of evidence suggests that they did, and therefore it's quite likely that they did. And they had motive. It wasn't just to do with a breakdown in the relationship between her and Prince Charles. She was becoming a bit of a threat to the establishment in various ways, not least possibly because she was going to get married to Dodi Al-Fayed, have a Muslim child, possibly convert to Islam. Who knows? They didn't want to take the chance.
Well, I think it becomes much more interesting now her husband has become king. Anyway, so let's go back 26 years.
We are today a nation in Britain in a state of shock, in mourning, in grief that is so deeply painful for us. She was a wonderful and a warm human being. Though her own life was often sadly touched by tragedy, she touched the lives of so many others in Britain throughout the world with joy and with comfort. How many times shall we remember her in how many different ways? With the sick, the dying, with children, with the needy. When with just a look or a gesture that spoke so much more than words, she would reveal to all of us the depth of her compassion and her humanity.
She was an exceptional and gifted human being. In good times and bad, she never lost her capacity to smile and laugh, nor to inspire others with her warmth and kindness.
You know how difficult things were for her from time to time. I'm sure we can only guess at, but the people everywhere, not just here in Britain, everywhere, they kept faith with Princess Diana. They liked her, they loved her. They regarded her as one of the people. She was the people's princess. And that's how she will stay, how she will remain in our hearts and in our memories forever.
Well, good old Tony Blair, sounding almost sincere. And also the Queen, I mean, the controversy, Martin, at the time, younger people may not remember, was that the royal family just expected Blair basically to do the honours and appear in front of the TV cameras. And actually the royal family themselves completely stayed away. And there was after about 3 days, there was a big sort of hoo-ha about this. Where the hell's the Queen, you know? And eventually she did a little speech, part of which you heard there. But there seemed to be a kind of uncomfortableness amongst the royal family of actually appearing in public, and they were leaving it all to the politicians to deal with.
Well, I think the film The Queen, which starred Helen Mirren as the Queen, covers exactly that period. And, you know, about how they tried to cope and they couldn't cope, and then Blair helped them out and all the rest of it. And it's obviously a bit not completely accurate, but if you're interested in that dynamic, that's what the film's about.
I mean, it's amazing to me that it took, I think it was 10 years before there was actually a proper inquest. There were several coroners appointed who started looking at all the papers and then resigned because there was so much pressure on them from the royal family to find the right answer. And eventually there was a proper inquest, and the verdict was, do you remember? Unlawful killing.
Mm.
So, you know, this is it's not an accident. Unlawful killing is not an accident, folks. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the question, of course, is how that unlawful killing happened. And there are a couple of books, very good books, which I will mention after we hear from somebody called Di Davis. And Di Davis, he was the head of Royal Protection at the time of Diana's assassination. But he doesn't believe it was an assassination at all. He says, at least, that he believes that the whole thing... this is an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? So you've got someone who's in charge of royal protection. But, I mean, in a way, Diana was a threat to the royal family. So by lying about it, he could be protecting them, Martin, couldn't he?
Well, he could be, you know, he could be part of the plot. You know, you don't necessarily believe people what they say. What they say is what they actually know or what they believe.
Okay, so let's have a listen to Di Davis now on the Mike Graham Show.
Yes, I was in charge of actually royalty protection at the time, and I got the phone call shortly after about 12:30 a.m. From my duty officer, and then events took place, and we were extremely busy, as you can imagine, and. My then deputy flew that morning to Paris to coordinate the event. So it was a huge affair. And yes, I certainly remember it. Didn't get much sleep that week.
No.
But, you know, going back to it, yes, it's tragic. But men and women have suffered far more. And I'm not deriding mental illness. It is a huge issue if you've got it. But, you know, there are men and women with no arms, no legs. And I don't hear them whinging to the same extent. So... my heart goes out to them. I do anything to support them, as most of us would. Unfortunately, this young, well, he's not young anymore, this man has had such a privileged upbringing, and thousands of people across the world lose their parents, and it's very sad and it's traumatic. Of course it is. I'm an orphan myself. You wouldn't be surprised to know at my age. No, seriously, you know, people do suffer, but they don't go on about it and don't have the platform, as he continuously does, to open his big mouth, unfortunately.
Well, that's the problem.
It should be about those men and women in the services, and great publicity, but let's talk about them, not Prince Harry, I always say.
Well, so that's this chap, Di Davis, who was the head of Royal Protection on the day Princess Diana was assassinated, saying that, oh, it's a load of nonsense, of course, says a lot of people talk rubbish, and one of them is her son, and that maybe he's mentally ill. Now, this is interesting, I find, because this is the same thing that was being said about Diana at the time, mentally ill. In fact, Jonathan Dimbleby, who was working very closely after the Martin Bashir interview, or around about the same time, to do an interview with intimate interview with Prince Charles, as he was then, was pressurised on the interview and in the book to consider this whole idea that maybe Diana was mentally ill. Well, of course, she was actually being bullied in the most horrific fashion by her husband, and she wasn't mentally ill at all. So it's interesting to hear these people now also saying, oh, well, Harry's mentally ill too. And I think this is a really abusive behaviour. Harry, whatever you might say about him and his wisdom or otherwise marrying Meghan, he was a victim of the either accident, whichever way you look at it, or assassination, wasn't he?
Well, they might have a case if it was an accident, and and of course what he's saying, if you look at what Parry said this week, is that when he came back from Afghanistan, all this stuff came up, and he'd not really, processed it at the time, and he's talking about his mental health, so that people, you know, to break down the stigma of mental health problems, etc. And of course you've got the former head of the diplomatic the Royal Protection Squad, who's clearly, you know, all this stuff about what about the people who've lost their limbs and all the people from the services. And I think we should be concerned about them, and we should ask why we went to Afghanistan in the first place. What were we doing there?
Absolutely right.
Where the people didn't want us. And of course we wrecked Afghanistan in the 1980s with our special forces training Al Qaeda and others to kill the Russians, or the Soviets as they then were, an extremist, fundamentalist, medievalist regime was put in power by our force of arms, And then we invaded again to remove that regime, and then the regime comes back, and all that has happened in that time is misery and indescribable suffering for the people of Afghanistan, a country we've invaded three times, and three times our army has been defeated.
I mean, it's a geopolitical reason why we were there, surely, which is to outflank Russia and that sort of thing, isn't it, to go around the other side?
It's actually to mess up Russia and China to keep the Americans happy. Now, if we were just carried on being a normal middle-sized country in the European continent and sorted things out like fixing our railways, we'd have been better off than invading Afghanistan, surely.
Yeah, so I think the chap we just heard from there, I mean, he's somebody who's just been employed because he's mates of mates, and he'll keep his mouth shut. Maybe.
Well, he's obviously a clear insider, isn't
maybe
he?
A
do you know what I mean? He's definitely going to be the establishment.
They do like to use these Masonic oaths to employ people who will keep their mouths shut, and he's saying Harry's opening his big mouth. I mean, this shows that he's biased against him.
Well,
he's
you've got the whole Tory media up in arms against
Harry.
Prince
has absolutely
Harry.
Every
they
right
like him
to speak out about his feelings and emotions about the death of his mum. You know, so can we just let him say it? I mean, that's not a problem. And actually, I've got a lot more time for Harry than I am for Meghan. I think he's kind of smothered by her. But anyway, the reason I brought this up is because there's a couple of excellent books out there. The Death of Princess Diana, I think it's called. No, or both of them. I'll put a link up to this on our show page, and the full interview with that Royal Protection Officer there you can hear on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But these two excellent books on Diana, because they, you know, well, it's well worth knowing the actual details. Now, what we heard there was a load of really just ad hominem attack on Harry, you know, about his personality. But if you want the facts of what actually happened in the inquest and what came out in the inquest, Noel Botham's book and John Morgan's book, How They Murdered Princess Diana, it are absolutely fascinating and great things to sit on the bookshelf. And I've got all of the details, largely. I mean, the main reason it seems that she was in the way, Martin, was that she was possibly going to be supporting Palestine. She'd already made the first inroads into supporting the Palestinians. She was just about to get engaged to Dodi Al-Fayed, a very powerful Mohammed Al-Fayed, a very powerful man in London. Also, the idea didn't necessarily strike the British establishment as ideal to have William and Harry with Muslim half-brothers or sisters.
Well, it's quite likely possible. You know, the motives are more to do with things like that than to do with, hostility from her ex-husband. I think that's the point that people need to realise. She'd become a focus for what you might be called an alternative, using the royal brand, as they would see it, to leverage herself as an international celebrity, but somebody who wasn't going to be under control. And that's what really probably both the palace and the secret services have liked that.
I can't stand it up, but I heard from an insider that the her and Dodi had plans to move to Egypt and for him to run in political circles in Egypt with her as his first lady.
All of these things must have been thoughts in the minds of these intelligence services who must have orchestrated it. Far more, and if they were going to get rid of that reason, they would definitely not have included Charles in the plot to make sure that they could do this without creating a further problem.
Well, I don't necessarily agree, because if people had gone to Charles saying they actually bumped her off and he didn't like the idea, you'd been all sort of struck. People like
that's
got to be
in. That's why you
got to be on the inside.
You don't put these people in the loop.
Well, I think you do. I think you have to.
No,
otherwise, they might
George
kick
w.
off.
Bush
they
did,
might kick off at a later date.
No, George W. Bush did not know that 9/11 was going to happen. The deep state did it. He wasn't informed. Cheney was.
What about the JFK assassination, though? You know, you've got to make sure that
LBJ was involved.
Oh, most definitely.
Edgar
Hoover, all the rest of them.
Yes.
So you've got to make sure the sort of people that might kick back afterwards against something like that are all in on the plot.
Well, yes, or you get rid of them.
That does tend to happen, doesn't it? Anyway,
no person, no problem, as Stalin famously said.
We will wind up our little look at the lovely, the wonderful Princess Diana from the interview I did many years ago. You can even hear the air conditioning unit kind of going up and down. Dave was in the studio with me when we were over at the City Academy recording this with the now deceased John Morgan. His book is How They Murdered Princess Diana, and here he explains one of the very basic facts, which is that if you look at the inquest, you'll see that when the medics first arrived at the scene of the accident, they go round to all of the victims to see how injured they are, and they score them on something called the Glasgow Trauma Scale. This happens all over the world, actually. This particular thing is used. And Diana had scored 14 out of 15, so her injuries were pretty minimal.
When the medics arrived, they did an analysis of Princess Diana's head condition. It's a standard thing that's done around the world in car crashes. It's called a Glasgow Coma Scale rating. And she scored 14 out of 15 in that assessment. Now, that's a really high rating for someone who'd been in a high-speed car crash, 60 miles an hour straight into a concrete pillar. But because the Mercedes is a strong car, of course, and what happened was when the impact occurred, she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and her body swung 180 degrees, and she was left sitting actually on the floor with her back against the front seat of the car and her legs up on the back seat. So she was in a position that she wasn't trapped. If you look at the Mercedes after the crash and before they took the roof off, you can see that the back of the car was virtually untouched, and they were opening and closing the doors, you know, the two back doors. And anyway, what happened was that the ambulance that was sent to the scene, it came, if you look at the time it left the hospital to come to the crash, it was travelling at something averaging about 6 kilometres an hour to get to the, or it might have been 8 kilometres an hour to get to the crash scene. I mean, that's ridiculous, because we all have a vision that a ambulance will travel quickly to a crash scene, you know, but this one didn't. And so, you know, did it stop? I mean, there's evidence that the ambulance was controlled by the people who were involved in organising the crash. So did it stop on the way for instructions? Whatever. Something happened that kept that ambulance from getting to the crash scene. It left the hospital about just a few minutes after the crash, and it arrived at the crash scene at 12:40, and it was not a long distance. I don't remember the exact distance, but it was quite short. So then you've got a situation where it takes 1 hour and 43 minutes for Princess Diana to arrive at the hospital. And that's a hell of a long time.
So that's John Morgan there speaking to me many years ago, well, probably a decade ago at least, the author of How They Murdered Princess Diana, which is particularly definitive because he has the British... the British police report, the French Paget police report on Diana's death, as well as the transcript of the entire inquest, and he references it all the way through the books. And what you'll see is that there wasn't the paparazzi that killed that made the car go fast through the Alma Tunnel. It was in fact several very high powered motorbikes which were ridden by people in a very aggressive manner, and that the driver was trying to get away from. He was never going to be able to get away. But there's also a lot of stuff in there about this Fiat Uno and the flashing light. So and James Anderson, who was driving that, a French photographer, he was found dead and his car burned out a few years after the Diner business. Anyway, fascinating stuff, made much more poignant, I think, now, because Charlie and Camilla, the Queen, who Princess Anne still apparently doesn't call the Queen, calls her the consort, Camilla, and there's a little bit of friction in the royal family that Charles has decided she will be Queen, because he's now in charge, he can say what he wants, but the Queen most definitely didn't want her to be. Anyway, Martin, we're going to have a listen now, because I've been down this week down at a place called Monkton Wild in WYLD in Dorset, just near the Devon border, looking at this amazing situation where this community is being attacked by its own trustees. Well, they say what they're doing is the right thing, but they are running these sort of disciplinary procedures to get rid of residents there and people who are working there and doing training there and all this sort of thing, because it's an educational charity. They do all sorts of rural crafts. They're absolutely brilliant. There is all sorts of rather sharp practice. So anyway, I'll put a link up to the web page that they've got. It's called Monkton Wild Court Case. And more importantly for me, it's a magazine that I've written for in the past called The Land Magazine. So this is not the first time this has happened. This is happening in various trusts around the country where somebody that sets things up, is then told, no, you've got to leave. And that's what's been happening down at Monkton Wild. So there's a kind of campaign around that, but it's been expressing itself this week, last weekend, this coming weekend, and all the week in what they've called a resistance festival, which is not a sort of traditional festival. It's much more like a whole load of really good free courses. And the idea is, please just donate to our fighting fund to keep our community, Martin.
Well, I mean, I listen with interest to what's happened, and I presume we've got clips of people telling us what's it all about.
Well, we have. We haven't actually got. I'm telling you what it's about.
Okay.
What I find most, I think, innovating about the whole thing is the amazing amount of expertise and brilliance that there is in country crafts and I suppose ecologic design, this sort of thing, that the people who have been frequenting that place over the years and are all supporting the residents' claims against the trustees. So let's have a listen now to one of the people that I met last weekend. His name's Jay Abrahams, and he designs often enormous wetland ecosystems. The idea is to treat water naturally rather than to send it down the sewage system.
Okay, this is my business, which I set up 23 years ago. I'm a microbiologist by training. Water, as I think the Temeran community has found over the past 5 years, is the basis of life and the driving force of nature. And that was Leonardo da Vinci said that, so we can't disagree. However, fresh water is a minute proportion of the water on the planet. So it's our duty, really, to conserve and to look after it and to use it wisely. This is some figures just showing what form this water is, and it's from the Permaculture Designer's Manual. So this is where this water is on the planet, and most of it is locked up or is unavailable to us or is salt water. So it's a tiny proportion of water that we actually are allowed to play with, and it's the primary resource for life. Without water, we have dust and no productive capacity at all. In the water cycle, when water is allowed to do its duty in the landscape, it is the basis of our production and our purification systems. And that is what I use in my design work at Biologic Design. And all of the work at Biologic Design is based on the permaculture design principles and P.A. Yeoman's key line system. The basis of my constructed wetlands for wastewater comes from P.A. Yeoman's work using swales to harvest rainwater on a landscape level, which is what you're starting to do here, to create living soil. And a swale is very simply a ditch and a bank that runs along the contour of the land. And therefore, as water passes from higher in the landscape down the land, falls from the sky, it's trapped and held high in the landscape where it can do its useful work. By infiltration, recharges groundwater. And trees and other fibrous rooted plants are an integral part of the swale in enabling it to function. So this is a P.A. Yeoman's farm that he tried this work out on, first of all. You can see there's a series of contours with the highest point being on the left and the lowest point being on the right. And each of those lines goes down about, I think it's about 10 metres. The swales are created along the contours, and at the end of each swale there is a pool, a reservoir created by a dam. The water comes into the swale, fills the pool or the reservoir, then overflows to the next swale, which then fills that swale, fills the next pool, and so you're retaining water on the landscape. And Yeoman's idea was to drought-proof farms in the brittle environment of Australia, where they have sort of 7-9 year cycles of drought and flood. And his idea was to drought-proof these farms. Okay, a reed bed is in my view, a chemical engineer's idea of what a natural wastewater system should be. It's basically a swimming pool, a shallow swimming pool, maybe a metre deep, full of gravel, with one species of reed growing in it, Phragmites communis growing in it. And 35 years ago, I came across reed beds, and I thought, that's the way to do it. And then, after 10 years in the conventional waste treatment industry, I was given the opportunity by the company I was working for to create some reed beds. And it was a 5-acre reed bed and a 7-acre reed bed. So these are large, large reed beds. And of course, I was over the moon. I was thinking, this is great, I'm doing natural wastewater. And that sort of feeling of elation lasted probably about 2 weeks. And then I was actually on site, and I was watching these 40-ton trucks coming in day after day after day, dropping tons and tons of gravel into these concrete-lined chambers. And then we were putting literally miles and miles of plastic aeration and distribution pipework into these reed beds. And I realised, simply because of the scale, that this is not ecologically valid. There's a huge embodied energy in digging up the gravel, taking it across the country, dumping it down. I then obviously looked into reed beds more fully and realised that actually reed beds clog up after 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 years because of the microbial sludge which develops in the interstitial spaces between the gravel, the little spaces. Also, the biological activity is only on the surface of the gravel particle. Whereas if one used a soil-based system, the particles are much smaller, and the roots going into the soil actually open the soil and allow the passage of water. So taking P.A. Yeoman's keyline system and swales, taking permaculture design principles, putting it together with my own knowledge of how conventionally we treat waste in machines, which use huge amounts of energy, I thought, what if we use these swales to harvest wastewater instead of rainwater, and we create a multi-species system based on soil, not on gravel? Surely that would be better. Then we could have a system that was actually not just purifying this problem, but was creating a lovely ecosystem, a wetland ecosystem, great for wildlife. We could also have a productive system that, instead of just getting rid of the waste and purifying the water, was producing purified water and the potential to create resources. And I thought, that's probably the way I want to do it. And that's when I set up Biologic Design with the theory in my head and had to then prove it. Now, since 1992, I've done just about 200 wet systems in a whole range of scales for a whole range of different applications. So the wet system looks at waste not as a problem we got rid of, but as a resource to be used.
That's Jay Abrahams there, wetland ecosystems. And I just find it fascinating that people like somebody like him can come into this business of trying to do water treatment plants and just have his own ideas and say, well, hang on a minute, why don't we just simply use some of these techniques that were used hundreds of years ago, or maybe a couple of hundred years ago, and integrate them into modern techniques. And we can do, not only, as he's saying there, not only to be purifying water to drink, but also treating waste in a completely natural way. I think, honestly, this is the future, and it's maybe one of the reasons why the Monkton Wild court case website is there, and why the place is under attack. So Jay Abrahams there. Various other people involved in all of this, including a guy that's been doing foraging. So we ought to try and get hold of him. And in the meantime, before we listen to him, we're going to hear from Kevin Carhill, one of the guests on here, who explains that actually what's happening now is more people have got access to their own land because of the property owning generation post World War II than ever before.
The very large part of roofs over your head that's private was actually a complete accident. It wasn't kind of There's no evidence anywhere that anybody ever sat down and said, you know, we're going to have people in Britain own their own homes. It was completely incremental, and most of it started in London. People started to be given this very strange form of ownership called freehold. Who are the freeholders here? Okay, most people think freehold is ownership. It's not. And the legal definition, oddly, is simple. There's only one landowner in the United Kingdom, and that's the Crown. That's what the government says in the website. Actually, they're wrong. There are two. Down in the West, there's another little landowner, all on his own. Prince Charles is actually the feudal superior of Cornwall. And the government statement is wrong. It's wrong about a few other things. But anyway, but basically, we, those of us who are freeholders, have a lease from the Crown. That's what our... The words used to describe how the leasehold gives us access and a freehold gives us access are out of medieval metaphysics. We hold an interest in an estate in land. What's an estate? What does all that mean? And there's no clear definition in the United Kingdom law books. It's a fuzzy concept to give the Crown ultimate ownership and to limit whatever anybody else has. It's so ownership is them. But starting in London, probably in the 1880s, with a kind of smaller effect in the urban villages and towns, people started to get this freehold, an indefinite leasehold, which did nearly amount to freehold, to ownership. But that's... The Land Registry, by the way, just to show you how it works, doesn't record ownership. Well, if you think about it, how could it? There's only one, and there's no point in putting her name on every parcel of land. She owns it all. That's the first thing. Now, the creation of this 65% wedge was, first of all, an anomaly. Secondly, it was unplanned. And the economists don't cope with or even think about the 30% of the 65% who have no mortgage. You know, they paid it off. People, you know, of my age tend to have paid our mortgages off. And it's a big lump, economically and everything else. But have you ever seen a book that explains the relative economics of home ownership and economics itself? Because I don't believe there is one. But here we are, we've wound up with 65% of us living in freeholds. But most of us haven't a clue what that is. And most people I ever meet have no idea the Crown owns everything. And the standard answer is, well, that doesn't matter. Well, actually it does. During World War II, the Crown took over 11 million acres, one-sixth of the United Kingdom land. The country is 60 million acres. The Crown took 11 million acres, a sixth, and they paid no rent. Well, how can you pay rent to yourself? Most of the land taken by the armed forces in World War II, there were other fixes. You were given money because the fences got knocked down by the lads running around and etc., etc. But rent wasn't paid because the Crown cannot pay itself rent.
Okay, so that's Kevin Cahill there. That's an extract from a longer talk from Kevin, former Sunday Times. The reason he got into writing about land here in Britain is because he was working for the Sunday Times in the late 80s and early 1990s, And at that time, he was tasked to look at hidden land holdings of the rich and powerful. So as people were going up the rich list, a lot of them had a lot of their wealth in land, which was hidden, very difficult to actually figure it out. And so Kevin's job at the Sunday Times was to find out where people had land holdings. And of course, if you've suddenly found that someone's got 40, 50,000 acres of land, which they've had in their family for maybe 800 years, that wasn't officially declared on the register, suddenly they go leaping up the rich list, and we realise that actually they have a lot more wealth than they're letting on. Although, funnily enough, in Britain today, you'll find quite a lot of big landowners who are land rich and cash poor, so they haven't got much money, but they've got fantastic amounts of land. Anyway, I'm joined in the studio now, and the reason we're getting into this topic is because a lot's been going on over in Brazil over the last few weeks. We were reporting a few weeks ago about the Movimento Sem Terra appearing in Congress, for example, which is the Brazilian landless movement. For many years, many of the peasants, we would probably call them peasants, people who are landless over in Brazil, have been having mass occupations of bits of land, and they're often getting shot. So it's a horrific thing going on. And the reason this is, for me, interesting is because this is a whole process of land privatization that happened here in Britain about 400 years ago, 300-400 years ago, the enclosures. So land privatization was the reason why we had an industrial revolution in Britain, because we had so many landless people that were then offered jobs to feed their families in the factories. And this was a completely organized process. So the powers that be had decided that Britain was going to have a powerful empire, and that the way to do that was to evict people from the land to start working in factories. Anyway, I'm joined now by Marcela Rees and Arif Jamal. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Let's have a listen now to Al Jazeera, who've done a report on the Brazilian indigenous rights as there are calls for protests to protect ancestral lands over there. And we'll be hearing from Marcela and Arif in a minute about what's been going on in here in Bristol, a protest on Tuesday this week. So over to Al Jazeera for a couple of minutes now as they explain the basics of the protest.
Indigenous people across Brazil once more facing threats to their survival. For 2 years, they've been urging the Supreme Court to take action and confirm their rights to ancestral lands. Tribal leaders warning Supreme Court President Rosa Weber that uncertainty has bred violence.
Take care of us. We can't sleep in peace knowing that our constitutional rights are being questioned, and that we are at the mercy of invaders who grab our lands at any cost.
The issue at stake is a landmark case establishing a time frame to limit the number of indigenous reserves in Brazil. If approved, only tribes living on their territories at the time Brazil enacted its constitution in 1988 can claim them.
We have a problem with that date. Before 1988, many indigenous peoples were forced out of their territories at gunpoint. Brazil was a military dictatorship and they had no means to fight for their rights. If the 1988 time frame is established, their land claims and hundreds of others will be annulled.
But even if the justices rule in their favor, Brazil's indigenous peoples are facing a still greater threat. This time from the conservative-dominated Congress.
The powerful farm lobby is pushing for a bill that will open protected indigenous territories to commercial activities, such as logging and farming. It also allows the government to reclaim existing reserves. Environmentalists say that this legislation not only puts the survival of hundreds of tribes in danger, but also that of the Amazon rainforest.
And with the clear possibility of conflicting rulings from each branch of the government, there's uncertainty on both sides of the debate about exactly what land rights in Brazil will mean in practice. Monica Yanakiv, Al Jazeera, Rio de Janeiro.
So that's the basics, but Marcelo, it does seem that there are quite a lot of indigenous rights already in Brazil. Surely the idea is to, for the rest of the country, that investors can come in and invest in, you know, and start actually making those lands more commercially productive.
Well, but the fact is that the indigenous lands, they are like preserved lands, and I think that nowadays we need a lot of these lands preserved because of the climate change. And we know that having trees, it is important in the absorption of CO2. And
well, I mean, that's a wider problem with the rainforest, isn't it? I mean, this is something I can remember since I was about 2 feet high, is that you've got a massive rainforest in the Amazon, which is being eaten into all the time. That's having a massive effect on the rest of the world.
Yes, exactly. And so nowadays, the reason why Brazil still have those forests is because, like, indigenous people have been there preserving them. And also with their land being demarcated, it's also like rainforests that they are not being destructed, or another business or agriculture goes there and invaded and cut the trees for more cattle ranches.
Well, look, you're Brazilian yourself.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about what is life like in Brazil compared to, you know, how long have you been living here in the UK?
I have been living here for around 7 years. So a little bit of my background. I grew up surrounded by a lot of nature. I used to go to some national parks, massive national parks in Brazil, and also play around with some indigenous community from the ethnicity of Krenak. And yeah, I've learned a lot with them. And at the same time, as I grew up, I saw a lot of these forests disappearing for cattle ranches, for monoculture, massive monocultures, also industries such as Coca-Cola and Ambev just going there and using our water and having rivers disappearing or polluted. And it is very sad because, of course, like, we see nature as part of, like, our life and seeing that all disappearing. And nowadays, we also understand how important it is to preserve those types of environments for our own survival of our species. So, yeah.
So, do you miss Brazil? I mean, what is it that you, I mean, what's the comparison for you between the UK and Brazil?
The comparison is I don't see so much nature here, unfortunately. Yeah, I know that there are some forests here, but yeah, it's still very little compared to there, and it is a bit upsetting. But of course, apart from that, there is a lot of good people here, and there is some parts of the culture that it's very nice too. So yeah, there is the good and bad and everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. Also, Arif, I mean, the culture that's under threat here, that's, I think, one of the most interesting aspects of this. Because, I mean, as far as I know, a lot of South American Indian culture was actually quite, I mean, when the conquistadors turned up, they found some quite nasty things going on. I'm not saying that I'm on the side of the conquistadors or Christopher Columbus, but they had, you know, these very draconian, strict priesthoods. And some say, actually, some of the communities that they came to take over actually were glad and felt they were being liberated by the conquistadors. So maybe you can just tell us a little bit, I mean, maybe get rid of some of my myths and tell us the sorts of cultures that Marcelo and you are trying to preserve here.
Yeah, this is very much a myth. And don't forget, you know, history is taught by the colonizers, so you're only getting one side of it, unfortunately. Yeah, the truth of the matter is, you know, what occurred was mass genocide. Certainly the early, we're talking, you know, centuries ago. And what's actually occurring now is a continuation of that, you know, just... it's instead of the conquistadors, it's now, you know, agricultural corporations, you know, wanting to take over land and kick the indigenous people off it. The cultural aspect is really important. So for the indigenous people, it's not like us. We are here in the modern world alienated from land, really. You know, we could move to Birmingham. It's not such a big deal, necessarily, depending on what you think of Birmingham. But for the indigenous people, their whole identity is based on territory. It's based on where they live, where their ancestors grew up, where their ancestors have lived for thousands of years. And so all their beliefs, their practices, their spirituality, you know, the plants they use for medicine, the animals they hunt, the spirits they pray to, is all tied to specific territories. So when you take off the when you kick them off their territory, effectively you are destroying their entire culture. And this is why the resistance from the indigenous movements in Brazil is so strong and powerful, and resistance to the Marco Temporal and similar bills.
Yeah, I'm sure the corporations would say, hang on, because the indigenous people have already got their reservations.
Yeah, well, as Marcelo was saying, you know, the history is complicated. During the many centuries of conflicts, the indigenous peoples have been decimated, effectively. They've been thrown off their land. So areas where they're traditionally occupied over hundreds of years, just because they're no longer there doesn't mean that's not their land. It means that they were forcibly removed from that land or murdered in some instances. You know.
Well, I remember up in Vancouver a few years ago, some of the Native American tribes up there have actually got legal judgments returning the land to them. So in some parts of the world, and I think in New Zealand too, things are going the other way, where native peoples are actually getting title to their land back. I know one of the things that always makes me laugh when I think about it, it's so absurd, is when the British turned up in these places, they said, well, these are heathens, we are representing God here, and this is God's land, so we will administer it. And then they started selling it off and saying that it was God's land. Now, this is quite obviously a fraud. They're just basically property speculators, property developers. And I wonder if maybe what we're dealing with now is the legacy from that.
In some ways, yes. In others, not so. But I think, yeah, in terms of Brazil, the demarcation process has been slow because of politically motivated legal wrangling, really. So I think there's more than 700 indigenous territories that need to be demarcated, effectively. And obviously, as I'm sure you all know, that the last 4 years have been complete paralysis in terms of those processes, because Bolsonaro deliberately stopped those processes. In fact, he reversed them, so he gave the invaders more power to take land. So we've seen a reversal in Brazil. And I think there is certainly a very, Marcelo might be able to talk about this better than me, but there's certainly a Christian evangelical element behind the land grabs as well.
Martin, we've got a bizarre situation, haven't we? Because Lula's now president, left-wing president. You would expect that things would be in our friends here's favour.
Well, he's the president, but as was pointed out in the Al Jazeera piece, the Congress is still under the control of more conservative forces. And Brazil is very divided, as other Latin American countries are. Argentina, the Bolsonaro figure, I've forgotten his name, is at the head in the opinion polls at the moment. So everything in Latin America is on a knife edge. Some countries are firmly to the left. I think Mexico is pretty firmly left-oriented now. But, of course, the history of this is that the United States and their corporations have been intervening in Latin America for years and preventing any democratic developments. So in Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, originally Bulgarian origin, but she's Brazilian, obviously, she was tortured by the military dictatorship before she became president. And there was a military dictatorship in Brazil from 1964 until 1988, backed by the Americans. And, of course, the corporations and the big landowners, the latifundistas, were in control. And
we even had some Nazi war criminals.
That's what, and of course, but as you know, Tony, lots of ex-Nazis ended up in Latin America working with the military in places like Ecuador and Peru and so on. But Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, ends up in Bolivia and he's involved in the assassination of Che Guevara. Now, this whole history is a tragedy, isn't it? You know, I mean, and it doesn't go away. I mean, the 1980s in Latin America were the lost decade of, you know, military dictatorships and extreme right-wing policy. And of course, over time, this actually deforms a society. And in places like Argentina, 30,000 people were horribly killed. And those 30,000 people would have been the decent leadership that could have carried the country forward. And this is what happens. You have a military dictatorship. They kill off all the people they hate. And then, of course, you can have an election because we're only dealing with the second and third team anyway. And, if, and don't forget, you're in debt to us. So that's a fundamental problem. But, of course, the, Lula's just been in South Africa, talking as the other BRICS countries. He pushed for Argentina to be included in the BRICS thing, which is probably a lifeline to the left in the Brazilian in the Argentinian elections that are coming up. But these struggles are not just going on in Brazil; they're going on all over the world, and they're all connected.
Well, that's true. I was looking actually over. I think Vietnam is a big land struggle going on over there, for example. Anyway, Marcella, what's can you just give us an idea of what was going on this week here in Bristol then on Tuesday?
So, because we were aware that the voting was going to take place on the 30 on last Wednesday, we decided to take action and bring awareness to the people here in Bristol to about this voting for this bill. And because I think we believe that this is a global concern, right? And I mean, if this bill is passed, a lot of these forests are going to like being destroyed and we're going to like release more CO2 in the atmosphere. And I think it is also about the caring of human rights. And I think when minority is threatened, all the other ones are also threatened. So that's why we decided to do that action and bring awareness about this bill to the people of Bristol and the UK in general.
Okay, so where did you go here in Bristol and how many people were there?
We went to the Cascades Steps and it was around 60 people.
Okay, and what do you hope to achieve now? Just a raising awareness or what else?
Raise awareness and also to pressure the government as well here, because you know that the government of European countries are putting a lot of money on the Amazon fund and a lot of companies are also working for the to fight climate change. So yes, we do need to put pressure when those things happens that it, apparently, it's just locally in Brazil, but overall, it's going to affect all of us.
How can people follow this? If people are listening, they want to follow what's going on there, follow you. I mean, obviously, you know, people do Twitter and you can follow Twitter, but then you're following 100 people and you miss everything important from the one you want. But what's the best way to keep track of this story for people?
The best way is to go to APIB's website, and APIB's, it's APIB official.org. And
then, what does that stand for?
Sorry, it's the Articulation of Indigenous People of Brazil.
Okay. Yeah. Good place to start. But I mean, this is a wider problem, isn't it? Bristol actually is an interesting city to be doing this, because we from Bristol went to do the sort of reconnaissance for genocide back in 1497 with John Cabot, having a good old look around North America. The South America and the Caribbean was more the Spanish and their side. But it was a horrific thing for the whole of the Americas. And now it seems that goes on, because the United States in North America is doing everything it possibly can to dominate South America, isn't it still?
I guess it's. I don't think it's quite as bad as it was as we were saying in the 80s. But certainly there's always a threat there, and there's always interests, especially regards to lithium, I think, is a big thing on the radar of the US. Huge lithium reserves in Bolivia and Argentina and Chile, for example. And there's no doubt, strategies in place to make sure that, you know, the US is, fully on top of that. But I think there's also a push from the the Latin American left to move away from the US. So certainly Colombia's new leader, Gustavo Petro, along with Lula and López Obrador in Mexico, these are very powerful countries, and they are uniting to unite Latin America effectively. This has been the long term goal since Hugo Chavez, you know, to unite Latin America and to build a power base that can resist the states, can resist the US. But of course, it's a long and arduous process, and very, very unstable, and dependent on sort of the political situations in each individual country.
Do you think the South America, as is happening in Africa at the moment, might be in danger of, well, saying, well, we don't want the American superpower dominating us, but you might end up with someone like China or even the Russians starting to dominate? You know, I'm just saying, it's not such an easy thing to be an independent nation anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think certainly the South American countries have seen China as a much better partner than the states, for example, for funding large infrastructure projects and sort of breaking free from the domination of the IMF and the World Bank. That, I think, has been quite a positive relationship. From my perspective, the goal really should be to unite South America, you know, in a block, really a separate block. But it's obviously easier said than done.
So, Martin, do you think that's ever going to happen?
Well, it's the long term vision of Bolivar from the 19th century. There was the conception was that we're going to have a United States of South America. That was his original ideal, but of course in the end it didn't work out like that, and but the vision of it still remains, and it's got a logic, hasn't it? It makes a lot of sense for these countries to cooperate together. They've very rarely fought wars against each other, which is why they don't really need huge militaries. Those militaries are just there to repress the local population. They're not used for fighting with each other. And I think the decision for Argentina to be admitted to the BRICS in Johannesburg could be very important, although what may happen there is that the Bolsonaroist candidate, whose name I've forgotten, will win the election, and then of course they will be saboteurs within BRICS, or they'll have to be expelled. And I think the same problem is Brazil could be playing a much bigger role in all of this if the Workers' Party had a stronger base in the country. They did have a very strong base at one stage. But, as you can imagine, there are very powerful forces that don't want these changes to happen. And I think one of the things that moderated that a bit was a lot of the big landowners in Brazil, they sell a lot of stuff to the Chinese. So they don't want to give up the Chinese connection. And Bolsonaro was told that we're not breaking ties with China because we sell them so much of soybeans and stuff like this. So there are tensions within all of these things. You know, the radical bloc versus the conservative bloc, they're all split into different factions. And, of course, for many of the indigenous peoples, there's a big question about whether they want to have it be developed at all. The mega projects, which could be a salvation, can also be a terrible miscalculation. You know, I think about the Carajás mining project in Brazil, which is basically sort of capitalist Stalinism. Just go in there, smash it all up, rip out the stuff, and then it collapses, which is always the problem with Brazil. You have a boom in rubber, a boom in this, then a boom in coffee, and then it crashes, and then there's nothing left after you've finished. All of these things are coming to a head in a global situation of confrontation. So there's nowhere that's not involved in this. Even in the most remote parts of the Amazon are engaged in this global conflict. They can't get away from it.
So Marcela, can you just remind us of the website that people can find out what's going on?
The name of the website, it's the PIB, so it's APIB, official.org. So perhaps if people just search the articulation of indigenous people in Brazil on the internet, they might find it too.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that We are planning an event here in Bristol on the 14th of October in the evening at the Palestine Museum, where we'll be talking about these issues in more detail and hopefully raising funds for a specific indigenous community in Brazil who are at great risk because their lands aren't demarcated.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that community now? Is that possible? Because, I mean, this thing, you know, it's quite nice, been quite nice to know this is something specific that has not actually been included in this legal definition of indigenous lands and that may lose their land to the international speculators, developers, the money men.
Yes, so this community is called Nomanawa, and their land is not demarcated. And of course, for obvious reasons, you know, the concept of private property and land demarcation just came with like the Europeans. And well, they didn't know about these concepts, you know, nature for them, it's for everyone and they have their communities and there isn't like limits for that. So this community in specific, it's based on the state of Acre in Brazil, in the Amazon area. And yeah, and we are very concerned about them because, for example, on their situation, if these bills pass, they're just going to be expelled. And I don't know, probably they are going to be expelled, go to the city. They are not going to have any support. And then it's just another case of this social issue that people just go to the cities, they don't have jobs, they don't have anywhere to live, and they just become on the margin of the society.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that particularly you might talk about lithium, Martin, is that with this rage about zero carbon electric cars, there are loads of indigenous communities in the way of these mining projects.
Yeah, well, in Mexico, AMLO has nationalized the lithium deposits in Mexico. The Americans are very unhappy about that. They're also trying to force GM corn on the Mexicans, and the Mexicans are resisting that. And, of course, when there was the coup in Bolivia, Elon Musk tweeted, we will coup who we want, get over it, because, of course, he wanted that lithium mine. But it's still in the hands of the Bolivian government, as I understand it. So all of these struggles are there to be had. I mean, people in Latin America are aware, if we don't take control of our natural resources, they're going to be taken off us.
Well, has Elon Musk been tweeting about the Gabon coup and the Niger coup and the Mali coup?
Well, I mean, he took it down after he tweeted it, but it was pretty indicative of his attitude.
Appalling. We'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and notes to your meeting at the Palestine Museum. Wish you all the very best with that. So Marcela Reese and Arif Jamal, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll go back now, before the break, to our little land rights struggle here in Dorset, down at Monkton Wild Court. One of the people who's very much supporting them, he has written a book called The Forager Handbook, which is about how you get food from the countryside and even actually in the cities too.
What happens when we stop managing everything to an obsessive degree is that the nettles and brambles move in. Fantastic, because, you know, nettles are an incredibly nutritious green vegetable. They're delicious. They're full of umami compounds. You can fry them up as crisps. You can use them as spinach. You can make a soup with mushrooms that's as meaty as any dashi stock. Brambles, obviously, what can I say? It speaks for itself. But I've just been talking to someone, and I haven't done this myself, that's been making a kind of thing that's a lot like black tea, just taking the young tips of the brambles and you kind of bruise them up a bit so they oxidize. Apparently it's a super delicious tea with lots of medicinal benefits. So I don't know, it's just to me like the wild ecology will start encroaching in a way that is actually beneficial the minute we just relax a little bit and stop being so control freakery about management and tidiness.
Have you got any special things you think are your favourites when you see a particular plant out in the countryside somewhere? Think that's, you know, something that is people don't know about, but actually is edible and it's really nice.
Yeah, I think so there's a plant called hogweed, which is one of my absolute favourites. I'll probably eat more hogweed than anything else. And obviously, a lot of people think, oh no, giant hogweed. which if you get the juice on your skin, it's
like a cow parsley type.
It's in the same family as cow parsley. So the cow parsley family, they all have flowers in the structure that looks a bit like an umbrella. So that used to be called umbellifus. Yeah, and hogweed is a delicious green. You can use the stalks just like celery. You can use the stems just before they flower like asparagus. You can use the seeds as a spice. It's used all across the Middle East, but for some reason we don't know about it here. It tastes a bit like cardamom and coriander seeds combined. And hogweed, yeah, it's just delicious for salads, for greens, for crunchy stir fry. You can do a, like a substitute for that crispy seaweed that isn't really seaweed from the Chinese shop. You fry it in oil till it's crispy and add a bit of salt, a bit of chili and lemon juice. Super delicious. And it's everywhere.
So that's Miles Irving there speaking to me earlier this week. Full version of that is up on our, well, will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, it's all about land. In fact, the magazine The Land that I was writing for says something about actually the only real resource out there is land.
Well, land with water, of course. You know, desert's not so good for you. Well, yes, I mean, the struggle, you mentioned earlier the enclosures in Britain. But in Southeast Asia, industrialization didn't come through enclosure. It came through land reform. So both in China and in South Korea and in Taiwan and in other Southeast Asian countries, land reform was essential to industrialization. So what you do is you stabilize peasant farming by getting rid of the landlord class. This is what happened in Japan after the war. And then you industrialize on the back of that without removing the peasant farmers from the equation. And it works better than driving people into slums. It's a much more efficient way of doing things, which is why China has leaped ahead in the last few decades, and Brazil, who ought to be much ahead of China, have not, because most of the land has been misallocated to the wrong uses, which actually blocks industrialization. And industrialization doesn't have to be a messy, messed up process. If you come to it late, you can use the cleanest technologies. And, you know, what we're talking about here is economic planning, which was gone out of fashion during the Thatcher era. But in actual fact, it's coming back into fashion because it's the only way to deal with lots of problems.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you managed to listen to all of Jay Abrahams' chat there about biologic systems that he runs. But that's exactly what he's doing. He's weaving all this stuff into the landscape. The idea is that actually the natural environment has all the systems that we need for free to use. We don't have to have all this massive pipe work everywhere. Yes, okay, it helps to have some sort of fresh water system in a city, but in the countryside, what you need is things like boreholes and the sorts of water treatment systems he's thinking of, and then you don't get all this raw sewage being discharged into the rivers.
Yes, I mean, permacultural solutions are definitely viable. We know that because they've been tried around the world. Yeah. What I'm trying to show is that it's not just a back to the land and romanticism. No. If you've got land reform, that is the first step towards industrialization. Same thing happened in Poland after the war. They gave the farmers small plots of land. They were given them by the communist government. And then on the back of that, they were able to industrialize. They then called people from the land to go to work in factories. And if you go to work in factories, you've got a higher productivity level.
I mean, it seems to me,
you've got to balance the two things.
We've got
out.
The opposite going on in Britain now. We've got increased landlessness. So the idea is people who are more and more impoverished, it's forcing more people onto the unstable private rented sector, with the council housing being sold off by to let landlords and things like this. That actually there's an it's that what's happened is we've hit the ceiling quite a while ago actually for security of tenure, the idea that you can't be thrown out of where you are. And we're now moving towards a situation in Britain, particularly with this cost of living crisis, where we're going to see increasing landlessness, aren't we?
Well, homelessness, I think, is what you're really talking about. As we can see it, I mean, there's been a massive increase in rough sleeping, and that's the tip of the iceberg of homelessness. And, you know, the house prices are now starting to fall fairly dramatically in Britain. And that, you know, ultimately that will lead to a crash in the property market, which will then lead to all the private rented people like myself being booted out. It's what happened in 2008. And there's no plan there, not from the current government, or not from the, it looks like the Labour government that we may get are determined not to do anything at all radical. They don't want to frighten the horses. But I'm afraid they may find themselves in a situation where they're going to have to do something radical because nothing else will do.
Thank you. Certainly this. Never take anything any government tells you at face value. Always question everything any government does or does not do. Always look for ulterior motives and always ask cui bono, who benefits. As far as I'm concerned, I will not be vaccinated with anything that has not been properly vetted and tested and has shown no sound scientific evidence that the benefits outweigh the disease itself and possible long-term side effects, which to this day we don't know anything about. I will not be reduced to a mere guinea pig by getting vaccinated with an experimental drug. And I will most assuredly not get vaccinated because my government tells me to and promises in return I will be granted freedom.
Nate is back to spitting these rhymes. Ain't nothing changed. Politicians still spitting their lies, committing crimes against humanity. They manipulate minds. They're about their business, depopulating mankind. This ain't no conspiracy theory. Yo, it's more like the truth. Nothing's new under the sun. It's just the cycle that loops. I believe in the unseen. I don't need any proof. I eat clean as can be without GMO foods. Have you noticed cancer seems to be on the rise? A moment silence for my good friend's father that died. I know a few deaths. Rollers are much harder to find. If you ask me, they pull the wool straight over your eyes. We locked down a country for a cough and a sneeze and a survival rate that seemed taller than trees. I'm not a doctor, nor am I claiming to be. It's highly likely they've been bought if they've been put on TV. My spirit, don't believe them, I ain't playing no games. There's a conflict of interest and they will keep it contained. See the meta universe sucking out the other day. It's not reality, keep it way. I don't need it explained. I ain't into that, I'd rather interact in person. My impact is like the sun when you pull back the curtain. And if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. I do not mind reversing, but until then I will stand in my truth and that is for certain. Do you know why the climate is changing? Look up, you will see the chemtrails that they're spraying. Manipulate the weather, technology is amazing. Sell you a climate crisis, but trust that you're faking. They're raking in the money, it's not funny. All these billionaires are scummy. They could put their money together and feed the starving tummies, but they don't and they won't because they do not care. Give to charities they own to keep the wealth within their sphere. When will we wake? Now is the time. This is revolution, yo, do not comply. Shove your QR codes, we will not be denied. This is revolution, I said do not comply.
Let's be clear about one thing. No one grants me freedom, for I am a free person.
You hope. Anyway, that's low key, I think, there. I'm not 100% sure, but revolution with a rebel and a notion, when a revolution there. And before that, we had the Jefferson Airplane from 1972, Won't You Try Saturday Afternoon. In advance of that one, we've got the Lacrimosa Requiem by Mozart. And before that, the hymn, The Day Thou Gavest Lord, has ended. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And I think we better start, Martin, with David Miller's at it again. If for people that don't know, David is possibly the best sociology professor in the world. Obviously, we'd say that as Brits. He's Scottish. I first came across him up at Strathclyde University, scribbling loads of books, pamphlets, and also looking at corporate power. It's a bit of a giveaway. His Twitter handle is Tracking Power. He's here on this program from time to time, as he's here in Bristol most of the time. We're about to hear him on Chris Williamson's Press TV program talking about the Israeli influence. But this is a massive taboo, it seems, within your beloved Labour Party, Martin, isn't it? The Israel lobby.
Well, it's not a taboo. It's an enforcement by the Israel lobby. You know, that controlling the Labour Party is a very key goal of theirs, which is why Shai Moffat from Mossad was recorded promising, the Labour MP.
Shai Massot, I think. He was a political attaché in the Israeli embassy.
That's right. So, I mean, the Labour Party is a site of struggle. And, the attempts to prevent pro-Palestinian, anti-Zionist politics in the Labour Party, the Israeli state puts a lot of effort into it.
David, we've covered the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit 8200, several times on this show before, haven't we? And it was mentioned, of course, in the video just now, wasn't it? I mean, can you just say a little bit more about Unit 8200 for us?
So, as with most states, the Zionist entity has a signals intelligence agency like GCHQ or the National Security Agency in the US. And, of course, that's different to its domestic intelligence unit. In Israel, it's called the Shabak or the Shin Bet. And its external intelligence unit called the Mossad, like the MI6 in the UK. So it's a signals intelligence agency. Mm. It's in the military. GCHQ is not sat in the military, but it's in the military in Israel. And the strategy that they've adopted is they have people who've come out of 8200 who have gone off into the tech business. And this appears to be a foreign policy strategy of the Israeli government itself. And so we find tech companies all over the world. We've just been mentioning Infosys, stuffed with people from Israeli intelligence backgrounds. We already mentioned the fact that there are 400 Israeli tech firms active in the UK, 400 of them. Mm. And most of those will have people from the Israeli intelligence agencies, particularly Unit 8200. I mean, the people from 8200 get everywhere. I mean, you mentioned Keir Starmer a minute ago. Mm. And of course, the Labour Party has a guy called Asaf Kaplan, who is a graduate of Unit 8200, running the digital media strategy. So, I mean, this is all over the UK politics and business. Sure. Are people from who are Israeli, ex-Israeli intelligence operatives, and who will still presumably be involved in some way in that role in their new ventures.
Of course, and all this, of course, was under the radar for many, many years, but Palestine declassified it, at least shining a light now on these sort of activities.
That's David Miller speaking to the former Labour MP Chris Williamson on Palestine Declassified. I was wondering what show it was, and then he told us at the end there, Chris did. Martin, this is pretty damn serious, isn't it, if your Labour Party digital communications is being run by Israeli intelligence?
It is, and people at the time were questioning whether he was a suitable person to be appointed. But, of course, the current clique that are running the Labour Party, I think we can call them that, were determined to have him. And you can see the direction of travel here. Do you know what I think may happen, where this may come unstuck, is if the right-wing Israeli government goes to war in Lebanon or Syria or starts a fight with the Iraqis, there's a lot of latent support for the Palestinians and opposed to the Israelis have a real struggle to keep their control of public opinion. So although they try very, very hard and they make big efforts to control public opinion in the West, there is actually quite, certainly in Britain, I suspect, quite a large number of people who think that they're a problem. And don't forget, if the Israelis go around creating fights and trouble, that means we're going to get bombs coming back here to Britain. And of course, as we know, Tony, it looks as if Mossad may have been involved in things like 7/7 here in Britain. Certainly they had full knowledge of it. So I think that what a Labour government will find is that they'll be put in a very difficult position when the Israeli government, which is extremely far right, does some stupid stuff, and then they'll have to justify it to the British people, which they won't be able to do.
Well, you might say, well, what's relevant has this got right now? Well, the United States and Israel are about to conduct joint drills simulating attacks on Iran. Now, this doesn't sound like a defensive exercise to me, Martin. The United States and Israel are holding their largest ever joint exercise earlier this year, and there's even more to come.
Yes, and of course Zelensky was saying that if he can't be in NATO, he wants to be like Israel, which implies that the Russian separatists in the Donbass are like the Palestinians. But there you are. That's possibly quite an apposite thing for him to say. So, and of course, certainly in other words, Ukraine is just going to be an armed camp like Israel to pursue Western interests.
I read this stuff and I think they really do want a third world war. The United States and Israel will simulate striking Iranian nuclear facilities as part of a series of joint military exercises that will be held in the coming months. The Times of Israel has reported on Wednesday this week, citing Israeli TV. Back in January, the United States and Israel conducted the Juniper Oak exercises, which were the largest ever joint drills between the two nations. The Israeli military said Juniper Oak was just the first of a series of drills the US and Israel will hold this year. Channel 12 reported one of the upcoming drills will simulate Israel facing a multi-front missile attack that involved the US deployment of Patriot missile systems. Another drill will rehearse a joint US-Israeli attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. Now, there's several levels of really, you know, you've got to call it insanity here. If you hit a nuclear facility, what's going to happen? A load of radiation is going to be released. Well, maybe because that's over in Iran, they simply don't care, Martin.
Well, I think that is correct. And of course, the Patriot systems will not protect Israel from the kind of missiles that Hezbollah has now got.
What about the Iranians, though?
Well, the Iranians will not just sit back. If you attack the Iranians, they will retaliate. They've got missiles that can hit Israel. And of course, the Israelis, basically, they live in a gated community where they don't actually get that much trouble. They just go to the shops and, you know, they're not happy with the government's policy on Netanyahu at the moment. But really, since 1948, they've never really had to fight. But if they go to war this time, they will have to fight, and that they won't necessarily win. Don't forget that the Russian Air Force is in Syria, and at any time they can shoot down the Israeli Air Force. They've chosen not to for political reasons. But if you keep pushing it, then that could be the case, couldn't it? It could easily be the case that a small country the size of Wales could be big losers at the end of World War III.
Well, while nuclear facilities are the target in the simulated drills, there's no sign Iran is actually looking to build a nuclear weapon, which was affirmed by a recent US intelligence report. Often missing from the conversation about Iran's civilian nuclear program is the fact that Israel has a secret nuclear weapons program and an arsenal of nuclear weapons that the United States does not acknowledge exists. So they're supposed to have, isn't it, between 200 and 300 nuclear weapons, the Israelis, and yet there they are pointing at the Iranians saying, oh, they might get nuclear weapons, we've got to blow up their nuclear power stations or their nuclear facilities, whereas actually the Iranians have also issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons. They don't believe that they're ethical. So there's all sorts of reasons to doubt whether the... of course, it could simply be that the Iranians bought Russian nuclear weapons on the black market in the 1990s. That's not impossible at all. But the fact of the matter is that destroying those facilities it would be in itself an enormous great provocation.
It would, because the Iranians, if they withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty... they would be within their rights in international law to develop nuclear weapons, especially because the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. We claim in this country that we've got to have nuclear weapons because the Russians have got them. Well, the same argument for the Iranians is exactly the same. Any government in Iran would draw the same conclusion. If you're going to have nuclear weapons, maybe we need them too. But I think they've concluded from a military basis they don't need them. They're not really usable. What they have got is missiles that can hit Israel, and they've got chemical and biological warfare agents which would do the same as a nuclear bomb if they had to.
Well, there's an element of, I think, paranoia in Israel, which could obviously be rather dangerous.
It is very. I mean, they're the wild card in the international system, and they are manipulating the West. You know, the West has its own strategy for bringing Russia and China to
heel. It's almost like every
Israelis have got their own strategy for dragging the West into battles that they want to fight.
Well, it's almost like every Palestinian child is a potential terrorist and needs to be categorised, handcuffed. Goodness knows what. I suppose it's a little bit like the sort of French in Algeria or whatever, where everybody, and the British in Zambia, where everybody they see is a potential enemy. And it becomes it's certainly mutated into in Israel is an obsessive racism, form of racism and apartheid. Anyway, Al Jazeera have been doing a series of documentaries on the extent to which the Israeli government is using technology to put Palestinians under surveillance. I mean, they're calling it an automated occupation. The idea is it's got cameras, facial recognition software, and I'm about to play a clip from the Al Jazeera program, The Listening Post, about the occupation of the automated occupation of Hebron, which is pretty shocking. You've got a situation, for example, where an individual Palestinian will walk up to go to work through a checkpoint, and a soldier will say, oh, hello, such and such. He knows his name. How is such and such? Because they've got such a thorough knowledge of every single individual that are all being profiled, Martin. I mean, this includes all those people that have actually never even done anything wrong. So they've got a massive database in Israel now being used with facial recognition cameras and all the rest. The other thing they do is they've got a little surveillance thing on their mobile phone. So as everyone moves around, they're being tracked facially, and any kind of microchip that's on them is also being tracked. So they've developed a kind of almost like a kind of digital prison.
Well, that's exactly what it is, isn't it? That's exactly what it is. And, of course, the thing is, it's not their country. if you were surveying your own population in order to try and keep them under control, as people claim that the Chinese are doing, that's one thing. But to do it to somebody else when you're not supposed to be there, and of course we're going to war with Russia because they're where they're not supposed to be, but the Israelis are where they're not supposed to be. And ultimately, if we're going to stand by our principles and all of those war memorials that we mawkishly have in this country, then we've got to stand by some principles.
Hang on, they're not necessarily mawkish, are they?
No, I'm just saying that if you're going to take seriously what they represent, then people who break the rules have got to be given what they deserve, and that includes the Israelis. What moral basis have we got to invade anybody while we're backing them up to deprive the Palestinians of their national rights? And that's Britain that did that. We're responsible for that, we're responsible for a lot of other mess.
Artificial intelligence has created what feels like a digitally mediated prison in Hebron. The military recently installed this autonomous weapon, a so-called smart shooter. It's powered by AI, which means it can shoot without human intervention. Amnesty has also documented the use of something called anomalies detection, sensors and algorithms that flag the presence of individuals or objects that the Israeli military would consider out of the ordinary. In addition, soldiers use a number of overlapping programs that collate information on Palestinians to monitor and govern their movement. The first previously unreported system is Red Wolf. That's the one used at permanent checkpoints, where Palestinians are biometrically registered and assessed against information held on them. Soldiers teach Red Wolf by pairing new faces with IDs and other biographical information. Then there's Blue Wolf, a facial recognition app Israeli forces use in the field, on raids or at temporary checkpoints, to capture photos of Palestinians. The third system is White Wolf, an app for settlers, allowing them to check if Palestinian workers have the correct permits. It gives the settlers access to confidential government data. Connecting all of this is Wolfpack, a database that aims to build a profile of every Palestinian in the West Bank, including information like a person's name, where they live, their family members, car license plates, and whether they are wanted or not.
According to testimonies from veterans, Israeli soldiers are even incentivized to compete with one another over who can collect the most data and photos of Palestinians. It's just one of the ways the occupation here in Hebron is being gamified.
This creates an idea that Palestinians are just objects out there waiting to be photographed, and that may help your unit to reap some form of reward, but is ultimately leading to dehumanization of an entire racialized group.
The Israeli military refuses to confirm its use of facial recognition. But in addition to the testimonials gathered by veterans group Breaking Silence, we also have a leaked training video for Blue Wolf. So it says here soldiers can identify a Palestinian in three ways: typing their ID number, facial recognition, or a photo of their ID. This is interesting. Soldiers can search for people using things like a car's plate number, but they can also attach information about Palestinians to their profile. So here it instructs the soldier to take a photo not just of the driver's ID, but all the passengers too. And when you look at this video, you can see why soldiers have dubbed Blue Wolf a secret Facebook for Palestinians. Blue Wolf enhances the military's ability to carry out what it calls mapping raids, when soldiers invade Palestinian homes to gather intelligence. Soldiers say it's part of a practice of making their presence felt. This raid on a home in Hebron shows what Israeli mapping of Palestinian communities looks like. Around a dozen children, still half asleep, forced to line up to have their photos taken illegally by soldiers.
Say cheese.
I don't think there's any point in history in which the creation of a database consisting exclusively of one ethnic or racialized group has ever led to any good outcome. We are dealing with something that we have recognized as apartheid. And in this context, the creation of a database exclusively for Palestinians to stop them from entering particular spaces, to stop them from being able to live fulfilling lives, to stop them from being able to access family and medical services. That itself is sort of re-entrenching the form of apartheid that we've been witnessing over many decades. It's creating a sort of a digital racial hierarchy.
Yeah, digital racial hierarchy. Anyway, that's just an extract there from the Al Jazeera program, The Listening Post, and I'll put up a link to that on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. It's called Israel's Automated Occupation in Hebron. Of course, it's almost like, it's maybe a bit too flippant a comparison, Martin, but trying to use the train here, getting rid of the ticket offices. The idea is this occupation is going to be managed by AI and surveillance cameras as much as anything else, and things like facial recognition software.
Well, the Israelis see themselves as the world leaders in this stuff. And the military industrial complex in Israel itself, the Pegasus software that was allowing people to hack mobile phones, they don't just do this in Israel. They've got allies around the world. So when I was in Colombia in 2005, I was looking at the Colombian army. I was looking, what is that rifle that they're holding? I was thinking, what is that rifle? And I asked the Colombians, and that's a Galil rifle. That's an Israeli rifle. And in fact, Israeli agents have been used in repression in right-wing regimes in Latin America. They work closely with the Taiwanese. They're very embedded with the British. You know, General Danet goes over there to schmooze with them all the time. And we are implicated in everything that they are doing.
I think the obvious comparison here is with the Nazi Hollerith machines, the IBM and the Holocaust by Edwin Black, who wrote a very good book, IBM and the Holocaust. And what they were doing there was supposed to be innocent at the time. All we're doing is we're just doing a list of your profession, your family members, your religion. But then, of course, as the 1930s progressed, suddenly it became that these machines were being processed through these IBM computers, which the Nazis had, and they press a button and it would tell them, say, for example, where all the Jews were in Dresden.
Yes, and of course, obviously, that is the trope of the investigation. So this is very similar to what went on with the Nazi Germany and the Jews.
The point is,
and of course, that
people, innocent people who've never, you can imagine, obviously, this sort of thing is necessary for people maybe that have committed crimes and that are dangerous in some way, can be proven to be dangerous. But what's happening here is every single person is going onto this system. It's almost like they're being dehumanized in the process, and that the Israelis are inflicting on the Palestinians what the Nazis inflicted on trade unionists and other German people back in the 1930s.
Well, in British political discussion within the Overton window, you're not allowed to compare the Israeli state to Nazi Germany, although you will find that in actual fact in Israel itself, brave critics of the government will compare.
They will, yes, much more than over here.
Far more so than we feel comfortable doing.
Al Jazeera, I think, have been very wise there in their programming and the production of that to not mention this. But of course, everyone who's watching it is thinking in the back of their mind, "Hang on, didn't someone do this somewhere before?"
There's a senior Israeli general who's come out and said, "We've got an apartheid state here." And he'd never said it before, and he said, "We've just got to face up to this." Now, the thing about this is, when you say people who've not done anything, blah, 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 and maybe it's necessary for people, they're not supposed to be there at all. You're not supposed to be surveying anybody. Your military shouldn't be anywhere near Palestinian homes or territory at all. And those who are the ones you are interested in, who might be doing something nasty from your point of view, in international law, they are freedom fighters. And they've got every right to fight back against you.
I'm sure you think it's stretching a point, Martin, but I would compare the ULEZ cameras, the Glutton cameras in Northern Ireland back in the 1980s and 90s, to this sort of thing, this mass idea of mass surveillance. So, with the ULEZ cameras, what's going on there? there is and the AMPR, automatic number plate recognition cameras, what's going on there is that the authorities have got a record of everywhere you've been, where you were 10 years ago, and if you were driving somewhere in your car, they know where you were. You don't, and they actually know more about you than you know about yourself. And the other thing is, of course, it's again is a mass surveillance system. And this week I contacted the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, to ask him about, he's kind of retired really, but to ask him about this, and about what he thinks of this expansion of the ULEZ. He's actually 100% behind it. He thinks it's great because he's campaigned for many years as to be, has been to, get people to use the buses in London, and public transport much more and leave their cars at home. But, you know, I tried to point out to him, well, there's a lot of people on the outer London that have, pensioners or whatever, there's no bus service there at all for them to use as an alternative. They just have to use a taxi or buy a new car. Anyway, so this is what he had to say about the whole sort of idea of the modern Labour Party. I also asked him about anti-Semitism too. So I'll put a full link to this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight. But this is what he had to say about the modern Labour Party and the whole... In fact, he started beautifully, actually, a clip which I haven't got, saying that he grew up in a city in London where everything was getting better all the time. And the politicians just did what the people wanted to and made things better. But after Thatcher had come along, slowly, the politicians are working for somebody else. They're working for big business and the super rich.
The real problem we've had over this last 30 years is, I mean, the richest are virtually paying no tax. They do all this money laundering and tax dodging. I grew up in that postal world, or even under a Tory government, everyone paid their fair share of tax. I mean, in the early 1960s, under the Tory government of Harold Macmillan, the top rate of tax on the richest was 98%. Nowadays, they're most certainly not paying anything.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, I'm not as old as he is, but nearly. And that was normal. Even Tory governments recognised that allowing the rentier classes to just walk away with loot was a waste of, you know, it was just stupid. Because by taking money off them and investing it in people and in infrastructure, the economy boomed and people were better off. The problem with the model of capitalism that's been imposed on us is it don't work. It works for the wealthy, but it actually, it's like cancer. It's destroying the real economy and therefore the society.
I mean, it might sound a bit trite, but what about, I mean, isn't it like, this is what happens in third world countries, or is it what happens in, you know, somewhere like Bolivia in the old days? I mean, it's getting better now, but this is where you've got a tiny elite of mates, people who are kind of looking after each other, and the rest of the country suffers. And this is one of the reasons I think we've been seeing these various coups going on in Africa. One of the reasons, obviously, someone is pushing it and triggering it, maybe the Wagner, the Russians and people like that. It's because the people in those countries for years, for decades, actually, since World War II, and many, many years, of course, before that in the colonial era, have seen all these massive amounts of natural resources being taken out of their country, particularly oil, obviously, because that's an obvious one. But the country itself has got absolutely none of that wealth.
Well, what you've got in many African countries and other parts of the developing world is what they call comprador elites. So they basically work for outside Western interests. They, like this guy Bongo, who's been enthroned in Gabon, he's the richest man in Gabon, and his family have run the country since independence from France in 1960. But of course, nothing has changed. The position of the CFA franc in West Africa means that it's outright theft of the resources, natural resources of West Africa, to prop up the French state so they can go to war with Russia and the Ukraine. And everything's connected to everything else. And of course, the imperialism has not ended. There was some hope at the end of the Second World War and moving into the '60s and the '70s of a new international economic order. It was being discussed in the United Nations. You know, we need to change relations between developing and developed countries. But of course, that's all been rolled back. We're back to good old fashioned 19th century imperialism. Do as we say, or we're going to invade you, or worse.
Okay, so let's look at the coup of the week. Would you like to name this country, this country of the coup of the week, Martin.
Well, I just mentioned Gabon.
It almost seems to me, and this, again, I don't know, I mean, I look at this whole situation, I think, well, the Russians are getting rather annoyed about what's been going on in Ukraine, and so maybe what they're doing is they're pressing a few buttons with Wagner and other people over in Africa and saying, right, well, we're going to be taking all those masses of natural resources. I mean, I'm not sure about Gabon, but Niger is amazing amounts of uranium, gold. It's an absolutely colossal country, and also, of course, lithium. So if all these resources are lost to the West because of their actions in Ukraine, that might actually be quite a good tactic to try and persuade the Western money men behind the Ukraine war to back off.
Well, I think the Ukraine war isn't just being fought in the Ukraine. Obviously, it's become a global conflict with everybody having to take sides on whether they're going to join in sanctions or not join in sanctions. And of course, all the world, apart from Europe, has refused to join in sanctions on Russia.
Okay, well, again, it's Al Jazeera that have done a good job on this Gabon coup. And here's one of the journalists from Gabon. Well, I'm not even sure if he's actually a Gabonese journalist. But anyway, Anton Lawson has been reporting on that for a long time. So here's Al Jazeera's report, followed by some thoughts from him about what's been going on in Gabon and why there's been a coup there this week.
A military coup in Gabon. Celebrations on the street, but a very different reaction globally. The takeover is being condemned by the UN, while China, Russia, the US, and EU all voice concern. So why has there been yet another coup in Africa? And what's the response of African states? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohamed Jamjoum. The president of Gabon, Ali Bongo, didn't have long to celebrate his election victory this week. Within minutes of the declaration that he'd won a third term, army officers announced they were taking over. The election was controversial without international observers or journalists, with the country's borders sealed. Bongo has been president since 2009, succeeding his father, who was in power since 1967. General Brice Oligui Nguema takes over as transitional leader, the army saying it wants to bring stability.
President de la transition.
The president of the transition insists on the need to maintain calm and serenity in our beautiful country. He pledges to preserve the economic tools that guarantee social prosperity at the dawn of a new era. We will guarantee the peace, stability, and dignity of our beloved Gabon.
President Ali Bongo is under house arrest. In an online message, he pleaded for support.
I don't know what's going on. So I'm calling you to make the noise. To make noise, really. I'm thanking you. Thank you.
We'll explore more with our guests in a moment, but first, our correspondent Nicholas Hawk has more from Senegal's capital, Dakar.
There's popular support for this coup because people have been expecting and waiting for the downfall of the Bongo family dynasty that have been at the helm of this country for over 55 years. What comes as a surprise is the man behind this coup, Brice Oligui Nguema, who is the head of the presidential guard meant to protect the interest of the Bongo family. He was, in fact, a close aide to Omar Bongo, the father of Ali Bongo. And then in 2009, when Ali Bongo came to power, he was sidelined, sent as a defense attaché to Dakar, Senegal, and also to Morocco. During that time, the young colonel amassed quite a lot of wealth, building multi-million dollar homes in the United States and in Gabon. Now he's distancing himself from the Bongo family, arresting his son, accusing them of treason, of abusing power, of corruption, and of stealing from state coffers from this oil-rich nation in which most people live on less than $2 a day. So distancing himself, but also appeasing foreign interest, the French and the Chinese, who have vested interest in the oil business and also in the mineral business. We haven't heard from the opposition, Jean Ping, but also Albert Onda Ossa, who's been the political opponent to Ali Bongo during Saturday's presidential election. Also muted reaction from the regional countries, from Equatorial Guinea, but also from Cameroon. Not a surprise, because they probably fear contagion of coups. Paul Biya has been in power since 1982. And President Obiang has been in power since 1979. But this coup is a break from the past and a hope that this can rebuild trust in the democratic institutions in Gabon. Nicholas Hawk for Inside Story.
In Libreville, capital of Gabon, is Antoine Lawson. He's a veteran journalist who's reported on Africa and Gabon for more than three decades.
I think it is possible if you have to be optimist what can be done for the country. But I think that France, President Macron, has to change the way they lead the politics in the African French-speaking countries. This is very important because what they are doing in Africa since maybe 50 years is to take everything from African community and they don't give nothing in return. This is very important to develop a country. There is something the French people, the French government has to do, and they know now things are changing, and what happened in Nigeria, in Burkina Faso, everything move now in Central Africa, in Gabon. Maybe in a few months, in a few years, something will happen in Equatorial Guinea or in Congo. This is certain, because this is a very good position for African to make politics, and this is not good for the democratic view of the African country. This is a shame to see that now people cannot live, and they have another very rich, the country is rich, and people cannot have, there is no student. All the 80% of the students in Gabon are learning in Europe, in America,
Antoine,
in Canada. University in Gabon.
So that's at the Al Jazeera report. The journalist in question there, by the name of Antoine Lawson Martin, he's actually a fascinating guy. Brilliant to have a proper journalist on telling us about this. He's predicting Congo and Equatorial Guinea could be next.
Well, there's obviously some kind of momentum building in this region. Especially the former French colonies are very unhappy with the relationship that they've had with France since independence, because they haven't really had independence. There's still dependence in former British colonies, of course, but the French are particularly, interventionist. The French military, the French Foreign Legion, so have been deployed quite frequently. And of course, a lot of the jihadism that they're claiming to be fighting, A, it's none of your business if there's jihadis in the Sahel. They're not a threat to you. But of course, the reason why there's been such destabilization is because the overthrow of Libya. And of course, lots of very extreme Islamist groups have got access to all kinds of weaponry as a result of that.
I mean, they seem to be running rings around the US influence in Africa right now. Grey Zone is pointing out that Obama's man in Africa is under house arrest as the popular coup has rocked Gabon. Before his removal in a military coup, Gabon's hopelessly corrupt President Ali Bongo was courted by Obama and fated from Washington to Davos. The US war on Libya, which destabilised the region, may not have succeeded without him in Libya, for example. Isn't that interesting? I mean, this is the Grey Zone, as always, doing excellent stuff. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Meanwhile, over in Niger, the French ambassador's been expelled, Martin.
I think he's refused to go. They've told him to go, and he's still...
They've got rid of his diplomatic immunity now, yes, and so he's going. He's being forced out.
Well, I understood that he was sitting in the embassy and refusing to budge.
Okay, so do you want the latest? France has ignored a deadline for an ambassador to leave, for its ambassador to leave, and is threatening military action. Niger's military junta ordered the police to expel the French ambassador from the country and revoked his diplomatic immunity. The ambassador, Sylvian Ité, was ordered to leave the country within 48 hours last Friday, but Paris has ignored the deadline. Despite the junta's new order for Ité to be expelled by the police, France is still refusing to comply. A French military spokesman threatened military action if the situation became too tense. French has about 1,500 troops in the former French colony still, really, and strongly backed threats from the economic community of West African states to intervene in Niger if Bazoum is not reinstated. Anyway, so it does look as if he may still be there, but Niger orders the police to expel him, so that's a bit of a standoff going on. There's a whole succession, but anyway, what do you make about Congo? Is a massive country, isn't it? Could that be next week?
Well, the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo is not really West Africa. It's further south and it's much bigger and there's a lot more, the whole of Africa, virtually all the states of Africa sent delegations to the St. Petersburg summit, Russia-Africa summit before BRICS. And I think what's beginning to happen in Africa and elsewhere in the world is they're beginning to see the Russians and the Chinese, as they did in the 1970s, as their allies against the West. And people in the West think there's all sorts of nostalgia for Western rule in Africa and in India and other places. In actual fact, we have always been the enemies of those people, and they, in their own interests, are finding allies who are our enemies. So the Russians and the Chinese are not supporting liberation movements like they used to do in the past. They're offering economic development and military cooperation to deal with terrorism, if you like, and also to just get the, you know, the Russians and the Chinese have no equivalent to AFRICOM, which is, you know, the American.
Well, they're not saying they do. I bet they do.
Well, they've got.
It'll be a bit more secret, maybe.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, they don't pretend that they're trying to run everything, unlike the Americans with their British allies. Woof, woof, you know.
So this is, I think, ongoing stuff. I mean, what do you make of this? My connection I made at the beginning there between Ukraine and the these toppling of these puppet regimes that the Americans have got in Africa.
I think you make the Russians are to playing a very cautious game here. They have not called for, they're against military intervention against these military regimes, but they're also calling for dialogue to create stability. So the idea that the Russians are rubbing their hands with glee about all of this would be wrong. They're very aware of the dangers of unstable, and that's why they opposed what happened in Libya. Because, you know, don't break things if you don't know what you're going to do when you've broken them.
Okay, so...
So I think what's actually happening in Africa, just as we saw in Pakistan with Imran Khan, is that the local people are taking action to do what they want to do, but they're not necessarily being put up to it by the Russians. It's just that the international situation has changed such that the possibility of kicking the French out, for example, is definitely there.
So this week, Tucker Carlson has declared, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. He reckons that inside sources in the States are telling him that the United States and Russia will be openly at war within the next year.
Well, you could say they're openly at war right now this minute, so it's not really much of a prediction from that point of view, isn't it?
I'm talking about maybe, you know, we're talking about attacks on U.S. soil and this sort of thing.
Well, yes. But anyway... is what I was saying earlier. I mean, if we carry on provoking the Russians, they're going to hit us in the face.
You shouldn't sort of flippantly dismiss this. I mean, at the moment, it's a Ukraine-Russia war, a proxy war with the West involved. And what I'm saying is it might be a direct war between the two with... God's help us, Grant Shapps in charge for the British point of view. I suppose he's a safe pair of hands as far as Goldman Sachs are concerned. But anyway, this week, Tucker Carlson interviewed Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary.
What would happen if the West succeeded in killing Putin? What would happen to Russia and its nuclear stockpiles?
Okay, so may I recall one of my experience?
Yes.
So I was Prime Minister exactly at the time when the change happened in Russia, Putin after Yeltsin.
Yes.
Yeltsin was very weak and getting weaker and weaker. And I do remember the fear of that time here in Hungary and in Europe as well, whether there will be a new leadership or not. So the real fear here was that there will be an anarchy in Russia.
Yes.
Putin is out and no new guy who is coming in strong enough to keep together the country, the nuclear arsenal and the army control and so on. So everybody was happy when realized that after he had seen Putin come in and started to control the military and the Russian power as a leader. So everybody was happy. I do remember that. So now Putin is in power for long, long years. We forgot about how dangerous when there is no strong leadership or interregnum in Russia. The interregnum is the worst case possible. So,
but that is our goal. That is the goal of the U.S. State Department.
Yeah, but it's a mistake. If this is the goal, it's a mistake.
That's just an excerpt from, and I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, Viktor Orban speaking to the glorious Tucker Carlson. Martin, you know, he's absolutely right, isn't it? This whole idea of getting rid of Putin really is a maniac's fantasy. But it's US policy and British policy.
It is. And, of course, Putin is an elderly guy, 70-something, and he could have a heart attack tomorrow. But if you think that would change Russian policy, you are deluded. Russia is in fact quite an advanced, and its modern structures are actually quite democratic. They didn't used to be. Yeltsin shelled the Russian parliament while we cheered him on so that they could force through the Gaidar plan to privatize the main assets of the Russian Federation. And that, you know, everybody in Russia remembers that, but we've kind of forgotten about it. We did control Russia when Yeltsin was in charge, and that's how Russians perceive it. That was British and American control of our country, and it destroyed it. And now we've got our own control back, and if Putin is very, very popular, he is going to stand in March, so there's going to be a Russian election in March, and then a presidential election in America in November. But the Russians are going to get their blow in first. Putin is going to stand, and he's going to win in the first round. I would guess he's going to get about 70 to 80% of the vote. The communists will come second. They won't have enough to get into the second round. Probably Grudinin will stand, as he did last time. And of course, if Putin's party, United Russia, were to lose power, the Communist Party would take over, and their views on Ukraine are even more hardline than Putin's. And then you've got the far right.
So you're saying that they would say, the communists would say, so for example, let's just throw everything at it and take the whole country over, including Kiev.
Well, no, I don't think they want Kiev. They're not interested in it. This was a delusion of the West. It was presented in the West that the Russians are invading the whole of Ukraine like they invaded Hungary in 1956, as Orban will know. The whole country was taken over. The Russians, or the Soviets as it then were, took over. But you can see what the Russians are doing. They're fighting for those parts of the Ukraine that don't want to be part of the Ukraine because they're not Ukrainians. And as Zelensky has said, we want to be like Israel, so that we will get loads of weaponry from the West so we can carry on oppressing the Donbass Republic people, who are presumably
Palestinians.
Well, Transnistria is just broken off Moldova. That was in 91, so you've got a separate jurisdiction there. It's not recognised by anybody other than the Russians. They've got a small Russian peacekeeping force in there, and that's settled down because they are, you know, along the Dniester River, there was a Russian-speaking majority along that river for a long time. You know, they've been there hundreds of years, and the Moldovans are Romanian speakers, and there's tension. Now, what may happen, there's all sorts of speculation about this, is when the Russians go on the offensive, if they do go on the offensive, what they will need to do is push across the whole of the southern part of what is now Ukraine, then he'd take Odessa and then link up with Transnistria. Or the other thing that they may do, I'm reading, is they may try and come in from the north, not from Belarus, because they don't want to directly involve them, and then sweep the whole Ukrainian army into a pocket in the East Ukraine, like a World War II style. Mm. But I'm not sure that's feasible, given modern weaponry.
Well, we shall see. Anyway, that's the end of our international roundup for now. And one of the other massive stories over the last couple of weeks, I did want to bring you something last week on it and didn't, but is this dumping of the radioactive tritium from Fukushima by the Japanese. And so I thought I'd track down our resident radiation expert, scientist from the low-level radiation campaign, Dr. Chris Busby, and ask him what, first of all, is tritium and what should we be concerned about? What are they up to? Now, as he explained to me, it's extremely difficult to separate certain types of chemicals because, as you know, when the nuclear weapons, or you may know, when nuclear weapons were first being developed, they had all this uranium, but they had to separate out the isotope uranium-235 from uranium-238. And so we've got a kind of similar situation with tritium, because this is an isotope of hydrogen, as is deuterium, also an isotope of hydrogen. So it's a very similar process that might be needed here to get the tritium out of the hydrogen.
I'm reminded of this whole business at the early days of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, where there was the need to extract uranium-235 from uranium. And they also said at the time, this is going to be extremely awkward, extremely difficult, but they did it. So why can they not do a similar thing with tritium?
Well, they can. I mean, in fact, a lot more easily. You know, to separate 235 from 238 is very hard because they're very, very similar in terms of mass. But to separate from 3 from 1 is actually not that hard to do. Although, of course, it does cost a lot of money. And they've got 1.3 million tons of radioactively contaminated water. So they would have to set up a special plant to do this. And they could do it, but it would cost them a lot of money. and they're not prepared to put that sort of money into it. They'd much prefer to just sit into the seat.
Would you like to hazard a guess at how much something like that would cost?
I couldn't really imagine. I mean, it would certainly cost billions. I mean, put it like that. Absolutely. They would have to have some sort of osmosis plant or centrifugation plant or something like that. And then at the end of it, of course, they still have a load of tritium, but then at least they could then reduce the amount that they've got and sort of stick it in a box for many years so that it didn't cause any harm. But they truly believe it's safe. That's the problem. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, who seem to be the lead in arguing this point about the safety of tritium, have said all sorts of things about how safe it is because the doses from the tritium are smaller than... I mean, there was one guy that I had to laugh, really. There's this outfit called the Science Media Center that was set up by a woman called Fiona Fox. And their operation is to have a load of tame scientists who head off any arguments about problems relating to health or basically anything.
They were very active during the COVID.
Yes, I'm sure they were. But anyway, I went to look and see what they had to say about... and, of course, they're all over the internet saying this, what they had to say about this tritium thing. And there was one guy there that they had from the University of somewhere or another in Perth, Western Australia, who said that to drink all of... If somebody were to drink all of the releases of the Pacific Ocean in terms of, you know, all the shellfish and fish and seafood and everything, from the releases to the ocean, it would be less of a dose than eating one quarter or one half of a banana. I mean, so it's this sort of cartoon science that we're up against, and these people are just liars. They're just dishonest, and they're paid to say these things. The reality is that tritium is very, very dangerous. I did a study in 2003 in the Plymouth Dockyard. This is when I first came across all of this. There was a guy called Ian Avent who was complaining about what he'd heard. There were high levels of leukemia near the dockyard. So we said, well, all right, okay, we'll go and look and knock on doors and do the sort of questionnaire study that we did in Burnham-on-Sea and what we did in Trawsfynydd near the nuclear power station and Burnham-on-Sea near Hinkley Point. And we can find out what's going on. And he did that. And we had about 700 in Torpoint and on the other side, Keyon. And we found about a 30-fold increase in leukemia in the wards close to the contaminated mud of the Tamar, contaminated because the Devonport Dockyard submarines just pumped the stuff out into the river. And so it gets into the mud and it gets into the shellfish and all the little worms and invertebrates and so forth down there. And of course, it gets into the people as well. And the people then get leukemia and then they die. And that's what we found. And we went down there and we had a meeting down there, a public meeting down there. And I met a man there who worked at the University of Plymouth, professor there now. At that time, he was just a research chap called Awadesh Jha. And he was also interested in the effects of tritium from the dockyard releases. And he'd done studies of tritium on mussels and various invertebrates that lived in the mud and found that very, very low doses, tiny, tiny doses, conventionally assessed. That's by the system of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, this business about energy per unit mass. He found that tiny, tiny doses caused massive developmental defects and chromosome damage and so forth. So we know that the tritium causes these effects in invertebrates. And from my own epidemiology there, we found these high levels of leukemia in people living near the dockyard. And more recently since then, I have looked at the health effects of sailors, the health effects in sailors, American sailors, who serve on nuclear ships. And we found there's a tenfold excess in cancer on sailors who operate nuclear ships. And I've just recently done a big court case in the Scottish courts for a person who, a man called John Forbes, who died of lymphoma. Of course, we lost the case because the British government will not allow anybody to win one of these radiation cases. But in that affair, we managed to get some data under the Freedom Information Act that showed that these sailors on the British nuclear submarines were contaminated with material from nuclear reactor. So it's more or less all tied up and sealed and delivered. It's just that the governments of the world will not permit anyone to believe this stuff and will continue to pump out all of this nonsense about bananas.
Yeah, well, can you just clarify where this tritium is coming from? Is it just discharging of cooling water from reactors in these submarines in Devonport, for example?
Yeah, pretty much. And in fact, I mean, I did a Freedom of Information request on releases from nuclear submarines in Holy Loch in Scotland in the last few months. I'm following this up now. I'm quite interested. I've sort of got my nose into it. And I got a response from them to say that the releases that they had given permission for the submarines in the Holy Loch to release 1 megabecquerel a year of tritium. I mean, that's 1 million becquerels of tritiated water they're allowed to release. And also carbon-14. No, two megabecquerels of tritium and 1 megabecquerel of carbon-14. And this stuff, it comes, all, both of these things come as come about as a result of neutrons in the reactor. Now, reactors operate on neutrons. That's how they work. So neutrons in reactors are what fly about, split atoms and cause heat to occur, and the heat is carried away by water, pressurized water reactors. But of course, the water itself, when the neutrons hit the water, they turn the hydrogen atoms into tritium. So the water is contaminated with tritium, tritium oxide. And of course, eventually they've got to get rid of this stuff. So they pump it through various ion exchange resins in order to try and get rid of it. But tritium is virtually impossible to get rid of because it's very close, tritiated water is very, very close to ordinary water. And again, you know, like I said before, it's extremely costly to separate the tritiated water from the ordinary water. So that's the origin. The origin is in the nuclear reactors, in the neutrons.
Dr. Chris Busby there, is the sort of key bit of a longer interview with him, around about 40 minutes, 45 minutes or so, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, takes you right through it. The key take home from all of this, Martin, according to Chris Busby, is that actually what happened with the discharges in the 1980s of tritium from Sellafield has potentially far more dangerous than what's being put into the sea from Fukushima. But this has also been politicised, hasn't it? Because we've had Korea and China now saying they're going to boycott all fish goods from around Japan.
Well, yeah. I mean, once you've got to a situation where your nuclear reactor has melted down and you've created all this waste, it's a bit of a lose-lose situation, isn't it? I mean, you shouldn't have had the nuclear reactor in the first place. But there you are, you've got it, it's broken down, you've now got this water. This is a long-term disaster potentially for the Pacific. It doesn't really bear thinking about,
I mean, it's
about,
almost like
it?
Every decade there's another one of these nuclear disasters, each one worse than the previous, possibly. I mean, he's talking about, we know about the Windscale disaster, we've got Chernobyl, we've got Three Mile Island. I mean, this is, though, is being touted by the British government, by the West generally, by the European Union, as the future.
Well, it's not just them. I mean, the Chinese and the Russians are very heavily into nuclear power as well. I mean,
the Chinese are coming out with these different type of reactors which don't produce plutonium.
Well, I mean, they're investigating nuclear fusion, and of course, if that could be made to work, then obviously that's probably a game changer.
And so, fission chips. This is the Daily Mail's rather good headline. Japan's Prime Minister has been on TV eating safe and delicious fish from Fukushima. But you see, this is exactly the sort of stuff that Chris is talking about there, cartoon science.
Well, I mean, the point is that if the Chinese say, well, we're not going to buy any fish from Japan, then that's the end of the Japanese fishing industry. There you go. Because, I mean, presumably they buy a lot of their stuff from Japan.
I mean, what
Japan.
You might call poisoning the whale.
Well, it is, and I don't see, I mean, I don't think there's any, whatever you did there, it was going to be difficult. Well, as Chris Crosby said, what they need to do is separate the tritium, it would probably cost them billions.
Yes, well, yes, but they need to spend that money. That's part of the cost of Fukushima power station.
That's right, and that's why nuclear power isn't economically viable, because once you put those costs in, then it's not really worth bothering with. Now, I'm not saying that we should close down nuclear power overnight as they've done in Germany, because once you've got a nuclear system, you might as well run it to the end of its natural life, because all the waste is still there, whatever else you do.
But don't build any new ones, especially the EPR, European Pressurized Reactor, which is already the one in over in China, was failing almost like straight away. Anyway, final item tonight. I don't know if you've got any comments on this. I don't think you probably will have, Martin, is an interview with Stephen Flowers. I mean, I like to try and get my occultic piece in there somehow or other. And this is about the Nazis and the SS and something called the Brotherhood of Saturn. Stephen Flowers wrote a book in the 1990s called Fire and Ice. And here he talks about the occult in the Nazi National Socialism.
I have a section of the book where it says, headed by a phrase, Hitler, the leader who didn't lead. He gathered all these people that had some talent, ability, whatever they had, and gathered them together and directed them, but very loosely. That's why Himmler, for example, who was into all of this neo-Germanic type stuff, runes and all, Hitler thought that was nuts. That was just silly. But he didn't say Himmler stopped that, because that's what floated Himmler's boat. You know, that's what he was interested in. That's what made him enthusiastic for the job. So I just got to, you know, let him go and let him be happy with his position. And that's, he will be a better soldier if he's happy with all of that. So he just let it go. And so he wasn't like the Bolsheviks or Stalin or someone like this. They were looking at, if you looked funny, if you looked a little like you weren't buying the line, the party line exactly, well, then you need to be exiled, sent to the gulag at best, liquidated, possibly also. But they applied ideology like a razor, whereas the Nazis said, you know, I mean, even if a Nazi official, high up Nazi, had Jewish friends, you know, a Jewish person, he could protect them. So they survived the war. You know, as a famous saying, who the Jew is around here, I will determine that. You see, it was like loose, you know. So they could accuse people of being a Jewish sympathizer or whatever they wanted to say and send them to a concentration camp. But at the same time, people who were actually Jewish could be protected by someone who was high up enough. And so that's because these people, like all Bolsheviks, Nazis, one thing they have in common, it all goes together. They are first and foremost gangsters. They're a group of guys who get together, and instead of saying, well, we're going to have this turf, we're going to have this territory, you know, where we run this racket. No, why do that? Say, we're going to take over the entire country and control everything and own everything. There's no greater heist or racket than that. And that was what both of them were bent on doing, and that's what both of them did. And I think Hitler was certainly inspired by what he saw Lenin do.
Is this,
and how he took over this country.
Is it because at one point, obviously, Germany was not even a country like France and England, and you had, you know, Switzerland, part Switzerland speaking German, Northern Italy speaking German, Austria. Is this why?
Well, this was Hitler's problem, and he, as he saw and describes in Mein Kampf, is that the Germans had no sense of nationhood. Now, wait a minute, our whole party and everything is nationalism. Well, what is the nation? Is the German-speaking people of Europe. That's what the nation is. But wait, they don't have this sense of nationhood, so I must make them, it's our program to instill this sense of nationalism. Whereas Germans, you go, I hear people who live in Germany, Germans themselves, will say if they're from Bavaria or they're from Prussia or they're from Saxony, all these old tribal lands that make up the country, they still feel First and foremost, they're Bavarians, kind of like I am as a Texan. We're Texans first. Right. You know, that's just kind of, it's a nation. You know, it's an identity, et cetera. And Germany is like that. And always has been, because it only became a unified country of, in any way in 1871. Although an ancient Roman historian named Tacitus wrote a book called Germania in the first century. And so there was a Germany. There is a Germany. The Romans knew what it was, but it wasn't unified politically until 1871, for, you know, almost 2,000 years later. And so Hitler's problem, as he saw it and he describes it, is I've got to instill this sense of nationhood in all of them and unify all of them. And then he reveals why he became an anti-Semite. He says, I wasn't raised that way. My father was not an anti-Semite. I was not interested in it. I realized that the way to instill a sense of nationhood in the German people is to have an enemy, someone that we can act against, someone whom we can blame for all of our woes, etc., just as a mechanical, propagandistic way of manipulating people's minds. This is, to have an enemy is essential. And so they were it.
So that's Stephen Flowers there. His book, Fire and Ice, The Brotherhood of Saturn. He's looking at the occultic organizations in Germany. He's saying, for example, things like that groups like Aleister Crowley's OTO and Golden Dawn were originally from a German group, this Brotherhood of Saturn. Not Satan, Saturn. And apparently there's some difference. I think fascinating guy, and this idea of looking into these, I mean, it's the sort of thing that David Livingstone does, of course, in his various books, particularly The Dying God, but obviously that informs this understanding of transhumanism, this understanding of Black Terror, White Soldiers, and this whole concept that David has got his head around very, very well, this occultic satanic network that's been going on for years, really founded with the Canaanites, coming through things like the Phoenicians and the Egyptians, but particularly Phoenicians, and through the Vikings, etc., that the ideology was basically pretty much the same. And before we finish tonight, we're going to have a little bit of a giggle with Patrizia. Thank you very much for sending me another one. And this one is about the Ode to Useless. Khan is out to get folk with useless Ulez scheme. A henchman for the WEF brigade, hiding behind the scenes. He thinks he is invincible, bossing folk around. No way back, no U-turns, tyranny counting pounds. This farce is busy spreading up and down our land. Until it happens in each town, folk will not understand. If driving is so negative, and the truth is they would stop. All cars, they say, don't measure up. Not charge them cash to shop. The wicker man has cometh, no doubt, this is truth. A creep towards mad tyranny now, every way but loose. Sorry does not cut it, Khan. Sincerely, is just a toy. When using dodgy info to enable your master's ploys. I guess that's the WEF she's talking about, quite right too. And you know, the comparison between the Israeli racist systems of surveillance over in Hebron, in that case today, and I'll put up a link on our show page to that full series of three programs that have come out May and I think June this year, looking at the horrifying use of artificial intelligence to manage the Palestinian problem, as the Israelis see it over there, is the same sort of system exactly that they're bringing in the UK to facilitate this whole idea of road pricing. And of course, penalising the people with the poorest, oldest cars, and scrapping loads and loads of vehicles at all at the same time without providing public transport as an alternative. So, anyway, that's it for now. We're going to be shuffling off and coming back next week, I hope, God willing. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, our guests in the first hour, and that was Marcella Rees and Arif Jamal, and of course our sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips at the Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find a podcast, the full length interviews, including the long one with Chris Busby this week, with Ken Livingstone as well. Story links, a comment page, and also, of course, that one with the long one with Viktor Orban. Fascinating interview, not being shown any of this on our mainstream media. I wonder why that is. It's the wrong story, mate, isn't it? And the comment page and our email address is at thisweek1word.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show, a talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
have more.